Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. All of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Pam DeLisio about the assault on women's rights here in this state. And this, again, another one of these, you got to give them credit. You got to give the radical right credit for coming up with such innocuous naming bills, such as the Health Care Facilities Act, which we all know is going to limit women's access to abortions and limit their access to their reproductive rights. But, you know, who could possibly be against the Health Care Act? Sounds so, well, just so boring and so... Who could be against it? We'll find out why when we talk to the state representative. Also in the second hour, Keith Johnson, president of the Detroit Federation of Teachers, going to be here talking about all the pink slips that were handed out and possibly the sit-down end of last Friday that got absolutely no attention in the Detroit news. There's a big surprise there, and we said it Friday when it happened. Nobody's going to pay attention to this because this is just workers coming together. This is just students coming together. These are just citizens bothering to take a little time to maybe talk to each other, which is not big news in the corporate-controlled for-profit media. So interesting times. Your calls, of course, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So today is the day. Still have a few hours. You got time to get to the post office and get that magic stamp on your envelope so the taxes are on time. And I'd love to hear your tax horror stories. And I'm sure we've got a whole bunch of them because the radical right is out there. Boy, they're in overdrive. Absolutely in overdrive with the distortions and the deceptions. We're going to talk about some of that tonight. But, you know, the president and the first lady have put out their tax returns, which I guess is customary, and according to their tax return, they earned a little over $1.7 million in 2010, and they shelled out a little over a quarter of it, about $453,000. The majority of their earnings came in the way of book sales, about $1.4 million that way, $400,000 for his salary as president, which I don't know that is enough. And I'm sure it's far below what the soon-to-be trademarked Sarah Palin took in last year, which is why I still don't think she's running for president. If the title were gold, she might be there. She might be there with her hand out going, here, fill my coffers, fill my basket. Anyway, the O's reportedly donated some almost $250,000 to charity, and I'm sure the radical right is, you know, combing through which one of those to see what subversive groups they're giving money to, and, you know, what charities the O's are making, with all of the quiver and all of the, let's not go down that path if we don't have to. But the reality is, like many of us, the Obamas reported a much higher income in 2009, They made about $5.5 million. I guess the books were selling better then. Not so good this year. The vice president and his wife also put out their returns. They combined earned $379,178, which puts them just into that top 2%. They just made it. And congratulations to them. They just made it up over that march. And like the Obamas, the super rich are paying less this year in income tax, thanks to the extension of the Bush handouts. And you got to give them credit. The very wealthy are doing much, much better on a number of planes. As where Obama's income went down, our super wealthy folks didn't go that direction. They shot up the other way. And according to the IRS, who tracks the 400 highest adjusted gross incomes in the country, and how much they pay in taxes each year, the AP used the 2007 data, which is the last one that's available, the newest one available. The average income for that group was about $345 million. And they paid a whopping 17% in federal income tax. Now, you go back to 1992, that same group, those same 400, they paid 26% income tax. And now you sit and you look at all of this discussion about deficits and debt, and do we have to ask why we have such a massive budget hole? Do we have to really have that conversation? Anyway, the big talking point, and I'm sure you're ready for it because here it comes. The radical right-wing talking point of all king points. You ready for it? The Tax Policy Center. They have data that shows 45% of you paid no federal income tax at all. You paid no federal income tax at all, nothing! 45% of households. And that's been the right-wing blathering point all day. Almost half the country pays nothing! It's the rich people. And this is the great talking point. It's fabulous. Because they take it and they spin it around and around until it comes out that only rich people pay taxes and we should be thankful to rich people. That's really the spin that they throw on it. Since almost half the people don't pay anything in federal income tax, we should be grateful to the very wealthy for paying it for us. Which is ridiculous. Because this is just federal income tax. It doesn't take into state taxes, it doesn't take into local taxes, it doesn't take into account sales taxes, excise taxes, you name it, it doesn't take Social Security taxes, it doesn't take any of that into account. It's just the federal portion of it, which I'm sure a good number of people listening here tonight, if you're a middle-class family, you're probably one of those 45% because you've got children, you've got a mortgage. You've got a whole bunch of deductions. You paid property tax. All of these deductions that they've put out there that the Republicans want to take back. Understand, they want to do away with the child credits. They want to do away with the mortgage deduction. They want to do away with all those things like Reagan did back in the 80s. Understand that the tax reform bill of 86 was all about closing the loopholes. For you, too. We lost a bunch of loopholes that helped lower the working class tax brackets. Corporations just lost them on the short term. They were able to spend some lobbying money and get their loopholes back, and then some, which is what's happened. And here's more. You know, more than half of the nation's tax revenue came from the top 10% in 2007. This is the other talking point. They're saying more than 44% of the tax revenue came from the top 5%. So we should be happy the rich people are there and we shouldn't tax them so much. Here's my problem with the spin that goes on this. The problem is that the top 10% are paying half of the taxes because they have the majority of the money. They're the ones who have the big pockets. They're the ones with the deep wells in their pockets that have not, they haven't overflowed yet. They're that deep. All of the handouts we're getting, they still haven't overflowed. And you and I are the ones who are struggling all this. And you look at Bernie Sanders, who I think did a terrific job of putting together the 10 worst corporate income tax dodgers. People like ExxonMobil, who made $19 billion in profit in 2009 and actually got money back from us. We actually paid ExxonMobil in 2009 just to be here. It was a, hey, you know, thanks a lot for being here. Here's $156 million. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. You look at Bank of America. They got almost a $2 billion thank you from us for just being here. Hey, thanks a lot. We appreciate you being here, Bank of America. We know you made, you know, almost $4.5 billion in profit. You know, here's another almost two because we like you. Not to mention all of the money we gave them during the bailout. So, you know, good for them, you know. And you look at General Electric, one of the top ones, one of the top thievery companies in the country, made $26 billion in profit. $26 billion. And got a refund of $4.1 billion over the past 5 years. And they're the ones, close to 28 factories in the last couple of years, have laid off a large portion of their workforce over the last couple of years, and yet we're still paying them, thanking them for what? And you go down the list, you know, Chevron, another one, made a boatload of money. We're handing them more. You know, the one I couldn't figure out was Carnival Cruises. They made more than $11 billion, and they paid just over 1%, 1%. In federal taxes. So I'm asking you, you know, at what point do we wake up in all of this? At what point do we say enough is enough? And all we hear from the radical right is that, well, we're spending's out of control, and that spending on those public services, that Social Security, that Medicare, that Medicaid, that welfare. You know how much we spend in this country on social programs? We spend 16.2%. 16.2% of our GDP we spend on social programs. According to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, that puts us right in the range with our neighbors up there in Canada and also the country of Australia. Canada spends about almost 17. Australia spends about 16. So we're right somewhere in there. Yet, interestingly enough, Australia and Canada both have national health care that covers everyone. We spend over 16% of our GDP on health care costs. Stop and think about that for a bit. Child poverty in this country. In the U.S., 20.6%. Over 20% of the kids in this country live in poverty. And in Canada, it's 15, and in Australia, it's 11. Nearly 27% of the folks in Australia, the over 65, have incomes below the poverty line. Just 27%. Here in the U.S., it's almost a quarter. And in Canada, it's just over 4%. Now, the unemployment, that social safety net that they keep whining about, that here we get about 26 weeks unless, you know, a depression hits, much like the one that just happened. In Australia, the benefits are unlimited. Unlimited. Now, there, you know, like the conservatives love to see us do here, have a bunch of requirements, a bunch of verification, that, you know, that you're out looking for a job. But in Australia, they've got job programs. They've got educational programs, you know, to actually help people get jobs instead of just pointing to them and say they're the problem. Now, you look at what's going on here in D.C. All we're talking about is making things worse for people who are already struggling. You know, they talk about this safety net and how it's pulling us down. We need to cut people loose. I'm sorry, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying the frame that the right keeps shoving down my throat that somehow the spending on public programs on old people and on children and on education is somehow caused to our debt. Because you look at some reality, Canada's GDP is about $1.3 trillion. And their publicly held debt's about 50% of that. Australia has about a $1.2 trillion economy. Their public debt is about 22% of that. Yet here in this country, we've got a $14 trillion economy with a $14 trillion debt. And we don't spend that much more or less than Canada or Australia. So I got to ask the question, where does this money come from? Where's it going? Well, the only argument I can make is we love to blow stuff up. Yeah, I heard over the weekend, 91% of our debt, unpaid war. Unpaid war.
We're right back after this with Representative Pam DeLacio. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Oversight and Government Reforms held a hearing on state and municipal debt. Tough choices ahead. They called on two governors with diametrically opposed management styles to testify, Governor Pat Shumlin of Vermont and Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin. Shumlin is of the mind that unions serve a purpose in negotiations, while Walker sees them as an impediment to government's functioning. Shumlin told Walker that if his goal is to strip employees of collective bargaining rights, he should just come out and say it. He told the Wisconsin governor not to hide behind a drummed-up budget crisis.
What Vermonters are looking for and what they expect is the same thing that they expect in Wisconsin and the same thing they wish for and expect in America. They want reasonableness. They want compromise. They want bright people working together to solve problems. And when you use vinegar, when you refuse to meet with unions, when you don't sit down and talk with them, when you take on an outright assault on a basic principle in a democratic society, which is collective bargaining, the thing that my grandfather, when he got off the boat, and others now rely on and relied on to make a decent living, to come from a beet farmer to success in America, the thing that built our country, well, that's a different debate.
Walker argued that collective bargaining isn't a right as defined by the Constitution.
No, because I believe fundamentally, if what we've heard said over and over again was a fundamental right, you all in Congress would be acting on it right now. You do not have collective bargaining other than Postal Service workers for the vast majority of public employees who work for the federal government for wages and for benefits. If it's a fundamental right, why aren't you debating it right here now? It's not. It's a government entitlement. Collective bargaining is important for the private sector. For the examples we've heard about the impact it's had on families and legacies, private sector unions are my partner in economic development. I work with them, and I hope to work with our public employees.
Okay.
But collective bargaining itself is not a fundamental right. Rights come from the Constitution, and nowhere in the Constitution does that clearly define that.
During the hearing, Walker admitted that he hadn't campaigned on stripping collective bargaining, but he added that state employees shouldn't have been surprised by his move.
No, and I'd say no, because for 8 years as county executive, I not only talked about it, I actually brought it up. I did what was called a reality tour, where I talked about the challenges that we were unsustainable and that collective bargaining was driving that.
When asked if Wisconsin teachers are overpaid, Walker said if the state moved to a merit-based system, he would even consider paying teachers more.
If we could set up a system where we rewarded based on performance and merit, I'd even be willing to pay more.
Well,
but we don't have that system right now. We have one solely based on seniority.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You know, 2011 has been a year of attacks on workers, on women, and really on the American way of life. You know, our friends on the ideologically extreme radical right wing, they want to roll back the entire 20th century and, you know, take us back to the good old days when workers were disposable and them there, womenkind, they knew their place. What really surprises me is that there are workers and women still willing to go along with this radical agenda. And I guess the only thing I can come up with is because it's their political team who's proposing these draconian misadventures that really took us hundreds of years to beat back. The most recently, Republicans in Congress were willing to shut down the federal government, you know, basically let granny go hungry, let those soldiers go payless, and really make everyone else's life a little worse off. Because of their blind faith political ideology. This latest assault has come by the way of the Pennsylvania House, House Bill 574, euphemistically named the Healthcare Facilities Act. And who could be against that? Who could be against the Healthcare Facilities Act? Don't know. We're going to find out.
That's why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Pam DeLisio to come on and talk to us. Pam, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, Rick, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I look at this bill.
Participate in the dialogue.
I look at this bill, 574, the Health Care Facilities Act. Sounds kind of innocuous. Sounds harmless.
A lot of the titles of a lot of the bills that I've seen come through recently have that same pattern, the Freedom of Choice Act, as it pertains to rolling back the individual mandate on the Federal Affordability Care Act, the federal care health insurance. They're all titled this way. They're almost misnomers.
Not almost, they are.
They are.
You know, and the truth of the matter is nothing against you and the other Democrats that you associate with, but Republicans are just that much better at this euphemistically named stuff, these acronyms. They're just so much better.
I've observed that. I'm a newly minted member of the House. I've been, was elected this past November, so sworn in this past January, and as a voter and a taxpayer, I found this experience very fascinating. I bring 30 years of solid experience to the table here, and I agree. They are very good at doing that, and we have to be equally as good, if not better, at being very quick and clear to explain to constituents the facts behind these legislative initiatives, or the lack of the facts. I have found them, a lot of them, to be without meaningful data or evidence to support a particular legislative initiative.
Well, I mean, the reality is they pull on people's heartstrings. They use narrative where we use fact, and their narratives usually win out, even if they're not fact-based and even if they're not factual.
They getting hung up on the details and the facts is something we don't bother with a lot of days.
So let's talk about some of the facts of this 574. Again, another one of these great bills. You gotta love the name, the Healthcare Facilities Act. Tell me what's in it.
Well, Rick, it is basically a piece of legislation introduced by the chairman of the Health Committee, Matt Baker, that would require abortion providers to fall under the Ambulatory Surgical Facilities Act and the regulations that govern ambulatory surgical facilities. And there's a couple of things here that are of interest. First of all, just the way the legislation was introduced in the Health Committee, it was introduced either a week ago or 2 weeks ago. Things have been happening so quickly, and most of the legislation, there's the opportunity for discussion. This legislation was introduced and the vote was called for immediately, and I do mean immediately, after the legislation was introduced in committee, and I think even the more seasoned members on the committee, certainly the more seasoned Democrats, were very startled that this was actually the vote. So procedurally, I was expecting the opportunity for discussion, which anything as important a piece of legislation as this was certainly merits discussion. Actually, it merits hearings. That's what I was going to ask for, that we hold hearings on this, and that would be a reasonable approach, and I fully expected that motion to be not entertained, and then would at least have had the opportunity to ask questions of the maker of the bill. None of that happened. They immediately went to the roll call vote, and it was voted for, and I think it probably took probably less than 60 to 90 seconds tops, as long as it took to read the roll call of the 24 members of the committee.
Well, I mean, this is the kind of transparency that we knew was coming, and I've been talking about this all the way up until the November elections, because Republicans keep talking a good game about transparency and accountability and oversight and this whole idea of a meritocracy, and, you know, we need to be out in the open, but the reality is you're talking about a dictatorial party who, they don't want any input from you Democrats. They've got an agenda, and they're headlong into it.
Well, it's definitely, in saying it's a concern is an understatement, and I understand a variety of pieces of this legislation are kind of cookie cutter and are being introduced simultaneously in a variety of states around the United States, around the country. So it's a movement. It's not even something that some folks in Pennsylvania feel strongly about. It's a movement and a part of an ideology that I certainly can't support. And I think none of the Pennsylvania citizens should support this in terms of the process that is not happening to allow that discourse to happen, which is one of the true keystones of democracy.
Yeah, I got to tell you.
The discourse piece of it. And it's, in this case, it's been totally missing. I haven't seen the bills introduced on the Senate side, but I am aware that the Senate at least had the good grace to hold hearings on theirs. This hasn't happened. So my opportunity will be when it's introduced on the floor of the House.
You know, here's the thing. As you've pointed out, and accurately so, I think, all of this stuff, the attacks on workers, the attacks on the environment, the attacks on women, all of these attacks coming from the right are centralized. I believe they're coming out of the Heritage Foundation or one of the other well-funded think tanks in Washington. And just the playbook being passed back and forth between Wisconsin and Ohio and here in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Michigan, you know, I mean, it's just being passed around.
That seems to be the case for some of these issues, and maybe with a tweak here and there. The interesting thing about this piece of legislation, as a variety of other pieces that I've seen introduced, is that abortion clinics are already regulated. The instance that tripped this in Pennsylvania, they refer to the Gosnell situation down in Philadelphia, and I represent part of Philadelphia and part of Montgomery County, so I have followed that whole debacle, that horrible situation in the news, and it is an absolute lack of enforcement on the behalf of the Department of Health. This is not a lack of regulation being in place and the lack of legislation being in place. This is purely and solely a lack of enforcement. The Department of Health has admitted as much as, you know, at least two people were let go when this came to light. And the grand jury in Philadelphia that was convened to review this matter even lauded the very good providers who were out there providing care as it should be provided to women and to safeguard women's health. And it were a group of these very good providers who had consistently reported this gentleman who allegedly at this point did all of these horrible things to the Department of Health and got no response. This is asking those current providers to escalate the physical plan of their practice to a point that is not necessary given the fact that this is a low-risk procedure. Therefore, a lot of these providers who do not or would not have hundreds of thousands of dollars to put into the upgrades necessary, and these requirements have no real merit compared to the procedure being done, would it probably need to go out of business to do that. It wouldn't make any business sense for them to proceed.
Yeah, but isn't that the
point? So with those providers going out of business, women's health is further jeopardized for those who need this procedure. And I'm a pro-choice proponent. This is an extremely personal, intimate decision in an event. And there's nobody who could make that choice but the person standing in those pairs of shoes. And to have no options, and this is where we're headed if the bill goes through the way it is, that's a very scary proponent. In fact, that's jeopardizing women's health, which is the real irony of this piece of legislation that ostensibly is there to protect women's health.
But isn't that the point? I mean, isn't that the point of all of this, to make it so cumbersome, make the whole process so difficult, so cumbersome, and so costly that people can't do it and are forced into other things? You know, and going back to this whole idea of a narrative, the right loves to use horror stories, to kind of shock people. And I remember, you know, as a kid growing up back in the 70s when Roe versus Wade was in the front of the newspapers, my mother telling me a story of a friend of hers who went to some backroom abortion doctor and ended up dying from it, which is why she was in favor of it. And I remember that story, and I'll probably remember it until the day I die, which is why, look, I'm never going to have an abortion, but I've got two daughters, and I want them to be safe. Do I want them to have abortions? Absolutely not, but I want them to be safe.
And that's what this bill does not accomplish at the end of the day because of the situation that it sets up. And interestingly, the way this piece of legislation in the House has been introduced and written, it really creates conflicting regulations with the regulations that are currently in place that govern this procedure, and it as it pertains to parental notification. Interestingly enough, the current regulations governing an abortion procedure are much more stringent than the regulations that govern an ambulatory surgical facility center. So there are the regulations conflict, but that's the least of it. It's the fact that this even exists and can undermine and jeopardize the safety of women because it will take providers out of the service delivery of this procedure and could possibly create more of those kinds of backroom opportunities, which are just extremely, extremely dangerous.
Yep. I mean, let's go back to the doctor who really had, it's alleged, had done some horrible, horrible things. How much of the oversight that didn't happen is the result of all of the cuts in those departments, of just people being overworked and not having the manpower to get out and inspect and to do the job properly?
I'm not sure. I'm actually, in the early part of my career, I was a licensed nursing home administrator, and I've been headed up two not-for-profit retirement communities over 20 years. And we were regulated by the Department of Health and had unannounced inspections annually or more frequently if there was a complaint filed. So when this came out in the news and I was, you know, understood that complaints had been filed but not responded to, I couldn't even get my head around that concept because I've been in an industry that's regulated by the Department of Health. And so I don't understand. I haven't heard that it was a manpower issue. I heard it was just a total non-enforcement issue, and I have not heard an acceptable reason as to why. I haven't even heard that offered as an excuse that it was a quote-unquote manpower issue, especially if it was just complaint-driven inspections. You know, maybe they're regularly scheduled inspections. Maybe they were behind. I haven't even heard that. They apparently just didn't do them at all. But it's something that's complaint-driven bumps up on the radar screen, and to ignore those complaints is just untenable.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So what should people do? How do we stop this thing? Because it appears the Republicans are going to steamroll this through. How do we stop it?
Well, there's a couple of things. Obviously, organizations like Planned Parenthood, both at the Commonwealth level as well as nationally, represent these kinds of issues and are very involved in this. And, you know, that's one organization that's also had their name derided very inappropriately and very incorrectly through this process. They do family planning, women's health screenings, and a very small percentage of their services, under 5%, is dedicated to this procedure. So Planned Parenthood taking the lead in getting out accurate information, and we're all asking folks to contact their legislative representatives and their state senators to ask good hard questions about this legislation. And I think not only just weighing in, I have a lot of voters who weigh in and tell me I support this piece of legislation or I don't. I think what would be even more impactful if they called up their legislators, particularly those Republicans who voted for this in committee and those that may vote for it on the floor, and they're voting as a caucus, they're voting as a solid caucus, to ask very specific questions about, well, what are we going to do since this industry is already regulated, why are we doing this? Because I'm finding that when I do ask these questions of my Republican colleagues for other bills that have come through, I get no clear and or definitive answer at all. Verbiage, but nothing that constitutes an answer that says we're doing this because of A, B, and C. And that brings out very quickly that this is nonsense on so many levels. So I would urge people to call up and specifically say, you know, this is already regulated. This is an enforcement issue. So why do we need this extra set of regulations? Why do we need, if a procedure room currently is 150 square feet, Why does it have to be a minimum of 400 square feet? Why do we need an RN full-time in these clinics, even when procedures aren't done full-time in these clinics, thereby raising the cost unbelievably high? And we're currently an LPN or an RN, which is an acceptable health professional to be present and accounted for. So there's on Planned Parenthood's website, and I'll put this information up on my health website as well, I would urge people to ask those very specific questions, because I guarantee you there's no good answer.
I'm right there with you. You mean it isn't 90% abortions like John Kyle said? 90%?
No.
Nine?
Okay. No. I beg to... I beg to differ. There is not.
Okay, well, I advocate for taking sleeping bags to the Capitol, and all the workers and women and all the people who this right-wing agenda is going after, find yourself a spot on the Capitol floor and sit down.
Well, I have a sofa in my office. The lucky person who draws the short straw can even stretch out on the sofa if they're willing to do this and be present and accounted for in that kind of way. So we can advocate on for those pieces of legislation that make sense and move us forward. And your comments earlier are correct. This is moving us. They're taking us back. They're taking us way back. And they're not only taking the country back, they're taking us way back. And this is not progress.
I'm right there with you. Pam DeLisio, Pennsylvania State Representative. I appreciate your time, and we may take you up on that couch.
Well, very good. Anytime. Thank you.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
So much fanfare, so little fare. And once you see it without the dazzling neon lights rippling across it, you won't be a fan. Unless you're a millionaire corporate executive. It is the highly ballyhooed Republican budget proposal. It was unleashed on us a few days ago in a high-voltage press conference by Paul Ryan, the GOP's wonky ideologue who now chairs the House Budget Committee. Ryan dubbed his plan, ta-ta-ta-ta, Path to Prosperity. And indeed it is. But prosperity for whom? That is the core question that should be asked about all prosperity claims. Ryan's budgetary offering turns out to be deja voodoo all over again. Two-thirds of the $4 trillion in budget cuts in his proposal comes out of the hides of the middle class and the poor. Take Medicare, which Ryan does. He would defund and privatize this effective, efficient, and wildly popular program of universal health care for seniors, replacing it with insurance vouchers that put seniors at the mercy of profiteering health care vultures. The vouchers would be worth about a third of what Medicare covers, so goodbye and good luck, old folks. But health care coverage is not all that Ryan's Republican prosperity plan cuts. The rich and corporations, poor babies, need another break, and the chairman delivers. Rather than paying a 35% tax rate on their fabulous incomes, Ryan generously cuts their rate to 25%, less than common working stiffs must pay. After all, promises the GOP's new voodoo priest, this governmental giveaway to those at the top would naturally tinkle down to the masses, generating prosperity for every American, just as it did in the reign of George W.'s presidency. You remember those golden years, don't you? This is Jim Hightower saying, as we say in Texas, never sign nothing by neon.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
That's where we're heading. We're heading down that road. Start auctioning stuff off. And what's bothering me is it's going to be at fire sale prices. We're not even going to get fair market value for half of the stuff that we're going to lose in this state. What I find interesting, this whole tax discussion that's been going on, really focusing on the spending, not on the taxing part, which is why I found Alan Greenspan, who is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, free marketeer, Ayn Rand disciple. He said that this weekend, he said on Meet the Depressed that we need to go back to the Clinton tax code. We need to let the Bush tax breaks expire. We need to go back to the federal rates that were in place during the Clinton years, which were even higher back then. And I stop and I think about this. You know, when one of their own comes out and says, look, folks, we can't cut our way out of this. You're going to have to start raising some taxes. What does the right do? Well, they change the discussion. And now we're seeing also on Sunday on Face the Nation, Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat, which again, you know, you got these, the Republicans and their Democratic, handmaidens, touting the same corporate line. And of course, Warner's one of the Gang of Six, who has come out and said, no, we're not raising taxes, not going to happen under no circumstances, but we'll consider going after Social Security. We'll consider that. We'll consider sticking it to that working guy. He said, quote, and I love this, it's beautiful, we're going to make everybody mad with our approach because we're touching every part of the problem. All the entitlement programs. Look at how you make Social Security more sustainable. Sustainable. Works well like it used to. Yeah. I've heard that somewhere before. Where have I heard that?
There's no surplus in there. It's a bunch of IOUs. Listen, $2.5 trillion of IOUs, which have been used to build the interstate highway system and all the things people have enjoyed since it was set up.
Two wars, tax cuts for the wealthy.
Whatever. Well, you pick your crap and I'll pick the real stuff. It was to do the highway system. It was to run America. Mm-hmm. And those are IOUs in there. Now, there's not enough coming in every month. You're paying in every month for me.
Oh, that's so nice. Paying in every month. And he goes on. It's Senator Alan Simpson from Wyoming. And he goes on to say
this. Thing was set up when the life expectancy was 57 years. That's why they set 65 as the retirement date. Now the life expectancy is 78, whatever it is.
Right.
And so we have to adjust that and make it work for the future people like you in the United States.
We need to make it work like it used to. Sustainable for people like you. Did you hear what he said? Life expectancy was 57. That's why they made it 65. They're going to reform it so it works like it used to. So it works like it used to. You're dead years before you have any hope or opportunity of possibly ever collecting on it. And one of the things that grabbed my attention and the reason I thought of that clip is he went on to say another thing that Senator Warner regurgitated. And this is another right-wing talking point. He says, quote, you know, part of this is just math. 16 workers for every one retiree 50 years ago. 3 workers for every retiree now. There's only one problem with that logic. Well, there's a couple, a whole bunch, but one that I see that's a massive one. For the last 30 years, the retirees that are coming have been paying an enormous amount of money into a big fat pot that was supposed to fund their years because they were the python going through the pig, and they were going to fund their own retirement, this pay-as-you-go system, they were going to fund their own. And Simpson said it himself. It's all gone. It's IOUs. You remember during the Bush years when he went around with his filing cabinet? It's all IOUs. Nothing down there but just filing cabinets, IOUs. Never mind that those IOUs are backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. Never mind that they're the safest investment on the planet Earth. Never mind that. No. It's all gone. And like he said, you focus on your crap, the wars. You know, never mind those people who died, never mind the people who were injured, never mind the families who sacrificed, never mind any of that. That's your crap. That's your stuff. I'll focus on my stuff, on the good stuff, the roads and the bridges and all the stuff that he claims our money went for. And they just don't want to pay it back. Now, I look at this, Jake, and the reality is this is an excellent opportunity for someone to stand up and say, this is why we need more jobs. This is why we need more workers. This could be something that we would be able to open up an immigration policy for. Oh, gee, maybe get some of those workers on the dole, on the rolls, the paying into Social Security. Well, gee, I don't know. Maybe, just maybe.
And the president of the AFL-CIO was on TV today, and he was being interviewed, and that was one of his points. You know, if we're really looking at this long term, maybe we need to create more jobs, have more money coming into the Social Security Trust Fund. And, as you have done many times, he said, look, there's a simple way to address this. If we really want to address Social Security, forget about using Social Security as a cure-all. If you really want to address the one issue, and that is long-term shortfall, you simply eliminate the cap. It's that simple. And those were his words.
The reality is Social Security is fine. It is fine for another, what, 2047?
32. I've heard estimates up into 37.
It is going to pay every single dime until 2037 was the year. And then it's going to pay 75% on into the future. That's the guesstimate. That's given the worst scenario. That's the worst scenario they can come up with. Now, they keep saying it's going to go broken, it's going to end, it's going to stop, it's all be done. The reality is 2037, it drops down. That's if we do nothing. We do absolutely nothing. Leave it alone. And that's what drives them nuts.
Well, and one thing you have to understand now, the baby boomers, as you and I both know, ebb and flows. The population, just like a lot of other things, if you're looking at long-term history, ebbs and flows. And the high water mark as far as people coming into the population were the baby boomers, those who were fathered by men coming back from the war, that huge influx of people from, I believe, about 45 up to about 61, I believe it's included. But that's going to, that over time, that's going to even out. And we don't even discuss that. It's like, well, you know, you got baby boomers coming in. The numbers are, you have fewer and fewer workers supporting more and more individuals. But that's going to even out in the long run. We don't even talk about that, which is a positive to not overreact.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to pick this up on the other side of the break. Your thoughts, comments, questions, what's on your mind? We're back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. It wasn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
As we have, and over and over again. So basically what you've got is you've got the Republicans and their Democratic brethren who are going pedal to the metal, balls out to their destruction plans of Social Security, and let's not forget Medicare and Medicaid. The vouchers for Medicare, they're not going to work. Never. Not going to work. And as for this idea of block grants for Medicaid, another terrible idea, and we've learned that lesson over and over and over again, because we know the blocks of cash will most certainly go elsewhere, and the numbers, they're going to be fudged, and poor people are going to die, period. That's it, period. You look what's going on in Mississippi. You've got the governor there, the cartoon governor, Haley Barbour, of the famed Hannah and Barbour. And you know, the thing is weird is he's a 2012 potential candidate for president. He claims that his enrollment in Medicaid dropped by almost 23% during his time. He's saying that through my leadership, we lost 23%. The reality is, even using his numbers, it's BS. They've changed their accounting rules, which is how they came up with this, and I'll explain it real quick. What they've done is they changed the accounting rules, and now they've used both to kind of, rig something up, basically lie, baby, lie. The old numbers counted people who were on Medicaid and then left for one reason or another and then came back in the same month. The people were counted as two. And if you came back, you went and came back three times, you were three. So he's using those numbers on one hand to say that, we've had the numbers go down. On the other hand, the new accounting, when you even come back, you're still counted as one, which makes sense to me. Here's where the whole thing comes to fruition. What he's saying is, since the numbers have gone down under the "we're using it once" scenario, we're still using the "use it twice" to estimate the high and the "use it once" to estimate the low. So boom, 22, almost 23%. Here's the reality. If you use both, you use it both ways, using the same accounting tricks that they used. If you go back and use the twice or three or four times, it's actually decreased by 3.5%. If you use it the one time, once, it's actually jumped 10%. And you go, how can that be? And it's simple. Because people aren't getting short-term employment. They're not going back and forth. They're just on it. And they're not going anywhere. But lie, baby, lie. That's what they do. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Ike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Ike?
All right, buddy. Yeah, I was in Mississippi. I volunteered for 6 months after Katrina. Lived in a tent in Biloxi and worked all along the Gulf there. Even did some work in Louisiana. And it's just crying shame how poor those folks are.
Yeah, well, the poorest state in the country.
If it wasn't for the community clinics, and a lot of those community clinics were set up with churches and, private donors, and they were getting a share of federal money as well through, I believe, through the Faith-Based Initiative office. But if they didn't have that, the state damn sure wasn't going to provide anything for them. I just wonder, I guess my question is when did the Republicans become the, oh, my God, I'm so scared I'm wetting my pants party? I don't understand.
Well,
They became that party when they realized that the lowest level of Maslow's hierarchy is what people vote on, of what conservatives vote on. So if you can scare people enough, look, they know it's all just a dog and pony show. But if you can scare people enough, if you keep the boogeyman out there, if you can keep that race hatred out there, you can keep all that out there. You can manipulate people.
Well, I don't know. I guess it's people are so wedded to their cable and their Xbox and all their little whiz-bang life that they just can't see themselves, sacrificing for anybody, for anything. I don't know. This isn't the country that I envisioned as I was growing up as a kid. I wouldn't even recognize it. I would have never dreamed that we would have come down this road, but it's amazing to me people don't remember history. I carry the moniker Ike from the military. It was my dad's nickname as well. And I've come to really admire Mr. Eisenhower and what he did.
You mean the socialist?
Well, yeah, to them now, yeah, he would be a socialist. But, the most amazing thing about it is he had a debt load of 125% of GDP at the time that, World War II ended. And he had to bring all the vets back and create all the jobs and do all the things he did. And, we came through it. That's why when I hear this little, this little debt garbage that they're talking about, I'm not impressed. I'm not scared. I'm not impressed. It doesn't bother me in the least. Like I said the other night, just because you owe a mortgage doesn't mean you don't buy food and electricity and pay your water bill.
That's exactly
right. We're
going
to pay it off. We'll just have to pay it off over time. I think the Democrats should start carrying charts with them and hold them up just like the Republicans are doing and show the facts for what they are and show the graphs and show what's happened every damn time they've done this, give away to the rich. It's just, the numbers don't lie. We've got to come up with revenue. That's all there is to it. And if it comes down to between us and them, I don't see any other way that it's going to work out other than us because just, we outnumber them 10-1.
And that's what some rich folks are saying. They're going, look, tax us some more. And we've had some guests on over the years who have said, look, we've done very well. We're in good shape. Tax us a little bit more. Help provide the infrastructure that we need. Help provide the education that we need. And by all means, pay for that police department that keeps my very wealthy mansion secure from everybody else.
Well, how about this? How about if we just tell the people out there in Texas and North Carolina, Texas is on fire right now, tell them and tell North Carolina and any place else, I don't give a damn. Hey, the federal government's broke. Why do you, why are you being a bunch of, government dull people? Why are you looking to the feds to take care of you? You take care of your own self. Have your own state take care of your problems. Is that the way we're going down this road? This is ridiculous.
That
man.
Is the conservative ideology. That's their ideology.
And if I sound tired, I ran into an oxymoron listener, some 20-something-year-old kid that's just completely freaking brainwashed, and I spent 3 hours trying to talk to this boy. I did everything I could with him, and, he's just sitting there with that idea that why do you want to punish the rich? And I keep coming back at him, and I'm going, how is it it's punishment to pay taxes to live in the greatest country in the world?
Excellent.
What's
point.
The problem? Why do you characterize that as punishment? That's not punishment. By God, in some cases, particularly if you're that wealthy, you ought to consider it a privilege.
Excellent point, Ike. I appreciate the call, brother.
You guys have a good night.
Thanks so much. And he's spot on, as usual, spot on. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this one with Keith Johnson from the Detroit Teachers Association. We're back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Oversight and Government Reforms held a hearing on state and municipal debt. Tough choices ahead. They called on two governors with diametrically opposed management styles to testify. Governor Pat Shumlin of Vermont, and Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin. Shumlin is of the mind that unions serve a purpose in negotiations, while Walker sees them as an impediment to government's functioning. Shumlin told Walker that if his goal is to strip employees of collective bargaining rights, he should just come out and say it. He told the Wisconsin governor not to hide behind a drummed-up budget crisis.
What Vermonters are looking for and what they expect is the same thing that they expect in Wisconsin and the same thing they wish for and expect in America. They want reasonableness. They want compromise. They want bright people working together to solve problems. And when you use vinegar, when you refuse to meet with unions, when you don't sit down and talk with them, when you take on an outright assault on a basic principle in a democratic society, which is collective bargaining, the thing that my grandfather, when he got off the boat, and others now rely on and relied on to make a decent living, to come from a beet farmer to success in America, the thing that built our country, well, that's a different debate.
Walker argued that collective bargaining isn't a right as defined by the Constitution.
No, because I believe fundamentally, if what we've heard said over and over again was a fundamental right, you all in Congress would be acting on it right now. You do not have collective bargaining other than Postal Service workers for the vast majority of public employees who work for the federal government for wages and for benefits. If it's a fundamental right, why aren't you debating it right here now? It's not. It's a government entitlement. Collective bargaining is important for the private sector. For the examples we've heard about the impact it's had on families and legacies, private sector unions are my partner in economic development. I work with them, and I hope to work with our public employees.
Okay.
But collective bargaining itself is not a fundamental right. Rights come from the Constitution, and nowhere in the Constitution does that clearly define that.
During the hearing, Walker admitted that he hadn't campaigned on stripping collective bargaining, but he added that state employees shouldn't have been surprised by his move.
No, and I'd say no, because for 8 years as county executive, I not only talked about it, I actually brought it up. I did what was called a reality tour, where I talked about the challenges that we were unsustainable and that collective bargaining was driving that.
When asked if Wisconsin teachers are overpaid, Walker said if the state moved to a merit-based system, he would even consider paying teachers more.
If we could set up a system where we rewarded based on performance and merit, I'd even be willing to pay more.
Well,
but we don't have that system right now. We have one solely based on seniority.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And, you know, over the weekend I got an email from Joe who, he reported that, he said, quote, I have my copy of the morning's Detroit Free Press, which was Saturday, and not one mention of what went on at CFA. Thank you for covering this event. And basically what I said over the weekend is nobody was going to cover it. On Friday we had a couple of folks who came and talked about the Katherine Ferguson Academy, the good old-fashioned peaceful sit-down act of civil disobedience. The reality is they were met with another good old-fashioned police shellacking. Again, they used the power of the gun to lock these folks up. And we talked to Nicole and Tiffany, who had both been arrested earlier on Friday evening. And something that Nicole said really caught my ear. She said that the Republicans were doing the same thing in Detroit that they were able to get away with in the aftermath of Bush's failure in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And that really grabbed me, because the reality is Republicans sure know how to exploit one of their self-induced crises. The reality, the sit-down action, something we need more people to be doing. That's why I've asked Keith Johnson, president of the Detroit Federation of Teachers, to come talk to us about what's going on in Michigan with the teachers and what's going on across the state. Keith, thanks for taking time for us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I look at what happened at CFA on Friday. You had a number of students and parents and concerned citizens go into the school and sit down and say, you're not closing this school. This is ours. And the police came in, arrested them, and threw them all out.
Yeah, the shame of it is Katherine Ferguson really is a salvation mechanism for many of our young women who become mothers at a very early age. Not only do they focus on their educational development, but they focus on their parental development as well, and provide what is truly an invaluable asset for these young women, most of whom go on to live very productive lives predicated on the lessons that they've learned about life and education and being a responsible parent at CFA.
And some of the things that I had read, they have an extremely high graduation rate for, as you pointed out, young girls who are with child.
Well, yeah, you know, and really the Katherine Ferguson Academy is really kind of modeled after a program that my mother, who I just lost 3 weeks ago, was involved in at Murray Wright High School in Detroit with the Infant Toddler Center back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. It was the first education center of its kind to be located in a high school, where they actually had a preschool and an infant toddler center that primarily was made up of children of some of the girls and some of the boys from Murray Wright High School. Katherine Ferguson Academy gives these young people the opportunity to focus on their studies, and they have a very close monitoring system to make sure that these young women are staying away from those distractions that can keep them from getting their high school diploma, and really keep them zoned in on being able to be independent, not necessarily depending upon any man to provide for them and their child, but teaching them about self-sufficiency. And it has truly been a remarkable story of success. And so I'm hoping that we will be able, with the community's assistance, to keep that school open.
Yeah, I hope so too. And let me take a break and extend my condolences for the loss of your mother.
Thank you.
You know, let's talk about what the sit-down action was about. It's basically, from the way I understand it, help me here, in response to the recently appointed overlord who handed out a bunch of pink slips, I guess, to every teacher, has set aside most contracts and is proposing a number of school closings in the area. Am I accurate?
Well, in part. In fact, he did issue layoff notices to every DFT member, including me as the president of the DFT, which is really an unprecedented move. Now, we certainly expected layoff notices to go out, because under our collective bargaining agreement, if layoffs are even contemplated, then the district is obligated to give a 60-day notice before the end of the school year. But to issue nearly 6,000 layoff notices was certainly unprecedented. As far as the school closures are concerned, you know, keep in mind that 10 years ago, we had over 177,000 students, and now we're down to around 73,000. So it would not be fiscally responsible to maintain all of the schools. But what is really kind of disturbing in all of this is the arbitrary manner in which school closings have been determined vis-a-vis what's happening with CFA.
So, you know, one of the women I spoke to on Friday said, you know, and it really grabbed my attention, that what they're doing there in Detroit is what they got away with in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, it's my view that, you know, they never miss a good crisis. Is this what they've done down in New Orleans, basically destroying the Detroit Federation of Teachers and basically privatizing the entire school network?
Well, they certainly seem to be on a track to try to make the Detroit Public School District really two separate and unequal districts. One that would be a group of charter schools, which I don't think is going to come to fruition. And then everyone that's left would be in the traditional Detroit Public Schools, saddled with a $327 million deficit, in which the district is in no position to ever recover, unless we're able to get some leverage from the state in order to generate additional revenue. When you look at all of the contributing factors, declining student enrollment, a declining city population, an eroding tax base, declining property values, it makes it virtually impossible to eradicate the debt, as I said, unless you give us the opportunity as Detroiters, which I am one, to generate additional revenue.
And how would you go about that? As I understand, your governor, just like ours here in Pennsylvania, adverse to raising any additional revenue, in fact, wants to give away what little revenue you do have.
We have actually, at the DFT, come up with a plan that we have discussed with the governor, and he seems rather intrigued by it. And I'll give you the simplistic version of it. I mentioned the declining property values in the city of Detroit. So therefore, your property taxes are going to go down as well. So let's say, for the sake of simplicity, if your property tax was due to go down by $1,000, what we are proposing is, since they've now given this emergency manager some unprecedented authority, he has the ability to put a millage on the ballot. So let's say if that millage were to pass, what we have proposed is that instead of your taxes going down by $1,000, they would only go down by $750, and that $250 differential would go towards the selling off of deficit elimination bonds, which would allow the district to restore itself to fiscal solvency and then hopefully move forward with a continued balanced budget. It is an out-the-box idea, but it also gives the citizens of Detroit an opportunity to be the captains of their own recovery, if you will.
Right. You know, I look at this idea that they've got this, and explain it to me. Basically a czar. I guess you basically have this overlord, this king who can make decisions with the stroke of a pen. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, I mean, if he has his way, yes. But, you know, one of the things I've been doing today, I've spent the better part of the day meeting with a group of attorneys, those that represent us, as well as from our parent organization, the AFT, developing some constitutional challenges to what has been passed here in Michigan. And I think that one of the critical elements that has to be in the equation here is that our emergency manager did not inherit this collective bargaining agreement. His signature is right next to mine on the agreement. So had these powers not been extended, what would he have done with regard to this agreement? He would have had to live with it. And so with him being a creation of the state, one of the premises upon which we will move forward, if he tries to abrogate the contract in any way, is that he's actually breaking an agreement between the state and the Detroit Federation of Teachers, which under our Michigan Constitution, the state is not allowed to break its own agreement.
Interesting, because one of the questions that I had is if they can break a contract with you, and they can break a contract with any of their other city contractors, why can't they break a contract with the bank to say that pay them back all the money that they own?
Exactly. And that is one of the foundations upon which our legal challenge will be predicated. So I've been criticized for being silent on this for the past several weeks, but the reason for my silence is that we've been strategizing, we've been researching, and you know, it's like in my day on the streets of Detroit, if you were going to go after somebody, you didn't send them a warning.
Right.
So we're going to call this a guerrilla warfare tactic.
So tell me tell me what you can about what the future holds for you guys. What's the plan?
Well, we believe that we have let me put it this way. I don't have any illusions that this will be an easy battle. I know that it's a very daunting task. But I believe that with the research that we have done and the constitutional precedent that we have identified, that should the emergency manager attempt to abrogate our contract, we believe that we will be able to go into the court and put forth a very meritorious case. Now, you know, when you take your case to the courts, you're pretty much at the mercy of the court. But we believe that the facts will speak for themselves in an irrefutable manner. So I believe that, number one, Detroit Public Schools, as we know it, certainly is not going to be the same. But by the same token, I believe that we will be able to offset or at least minimize some of the presumed authority that the emergency manager believes that he has.
Let me ask you this. The layoff notices went out. So when did the layoffs start, and are you eligible for unemployment, and does it apply to everyone who received one of the notices?
Excellent question. In fact, we put on our website that the effective date of the layoff notice is the end of the day on July the 29th, which coincidentally is the last day of summer school. So what we have told our members is that if they do not receive a letter of rescission by August the 29th, that on Monday, by July 29th,
right,
on Monday, August the 1st, immediately go and apply for unemployment compensation.
And then what I say to do is once they apply for unemployment, get a sleeping bag, go to Lansing, and have every one of your teachers camp out in the Capitol.
That would be a statement. But you know, I think that the other thing that we have to certainly bring to light is the fact that as the governor and the emergency manager talk about being fiscally responsible, if by our members applying for unemployment and being eligible for unemployment compensation, this puts an additional economic burden both on the state and the school district,
yep,
that neither entity can afford.
Yeah,
so it was really a very foolish move on the part of the state to insist that the district make the effective date July 29th. And the district did put up resistance. The district wanted to have the effective date, the end of the day, August the 26th, which is the last day of summer school. Last day of summer vacation. Teachers are scheduled to report on the 29th of August. If they had gone that way, then our members would not have been eligible for unemployment compensation until August the 29th, but now they'll be eligible on August the 1st.
That's
a month's worth of unemployment compensation that the state and the district will have to kick out.
And a good time to take a vacation at the Capitol.
It's a good time to take a vacation at the Capitol. Lansing is beautiful that time of year.
Sure it is. And I saw the Capitol from inside one of the rallies you guys had recently. It's a beautiful Capitol to camp out in.
It is.
Just like we did in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
Would you let us know what's going on? Keep us apprised of what's going on?
I would be more than happy to. I've got your number and you've got mine.
Thank you, Keith. I appreciate it. Keith Johnson.
Thank you.
President of the Detroit Federation of Teachers. Keith, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome. My pleasure.
All right. Have a great night. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm taking all our money and shipping it offshore.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
So much fanfare, so little fare. And once you see it without the dazzling neon lights rippling across it, you won't be a fan. Unless you're a millionaire corporate executive. It is the highly ballyhooed Republican budget proposal. It was unleashed on us a few days ago in a high-voltage press conference by Paul Ryan, the GOP's wonky ideologue who now chairs the House Budget Committee. Ryan dubbed his plan, ta-ta-ta-ta, Path to Prosperity. And indeed it is. But prosperity for whom? That is the core question that should be asked about all prosperity claims. Ryan's budgetary offering turns out to be deja voodoo all over again. Two-thirds of the $4 trillion in budget cuts in his proposal comes out of the hides of the middle class and the poor. Take Medicare, which Ryan does. He would defund and privatize this effective, efficient, and wildly popular program of universal health care for seniors, replacing it with insurance vouchers that put seniors at the mercy of profiteering health care vultures. The vouchers would be worth about a third of what Medicare covers, so goodbye and good luck, old folks. But health care coverage is not all that Ryan's Republican prosperity plan cuts. The rich and corporations, poor babies, need another break, and the chairman delivers. Rather than paying a 35% tax rate on their fabulous incomes, Ryan generously cuts their rate to 25%, less than common working stiffs must pay. After all, promises the GOP's new voodoo priest, this governmental giveaway to those at the top would naturally tinkle down to the masses, generating prosperity for every American, just as it did in the reign of George W.'s presidency. You remember those golden years, don't you? This is Jim Hightower saying, as we say in Texas, never sign nothing by neon. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Interesting story that came out of Wisconsin this weekend. The Wisconsin News. Basically, what's going on in the state of Wisconsin is the public sector workers are going, what? I'm going to get the shaft? I might as well go take what I've got and go somewhere else and leave. And you got Walker going, oh, please don't go. I didn't mean those attacks to be aimed at you. It's just those union bosses I was going after. Basically begging, please, oh, please stay, please. And what I find interesting is that they act like, oh, big surprise. There are people leaving schools, people leaving the profession. They're leaving the public employ. Because they're tired of getting beat up on. They're tired of being the kid that gets sand kicked in his face. They're tired of it. And I got to be honest with you. I would be too. You know, you go back to this and it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy on one hand that, you know, part of me thinks Walker wants them all to go so he can privatize all those jobs, to the private sector and they can make a huge profit off of it. But the reality is a lot of those jobs, no matter how much you pay out, nobody's going to do because there's not a big profit in it down the road. On the short term, sure, they'll make some money. But over the long haul, I don't think so, Jake. And, you know, you remember that guy? I talked about the guy that I saw there in Wisconsin who he was complaining that the guy who was ahead of me retired, went and took a job in the private sector doing the exact same job for twice as much money. Instead of being angry about the guy retiring and I don't know, man.
Well, the unfairness of it is, and Walker, I don't think it has any idea. There's a lot of people who work for the state. They don't make an awful lot of money, but they feel good because they're serving the public. And if you treat them shabbily and you give them the impression that you're either going to eliminate your jobs or you don't have a lot of respect, they're not going to have that incentive. They're going to say, hey, look, I can retire. I don't need this. And I don't blame them at all. I mean, look at our buddy Mike. I mean, he said several times on the air that, you know, if it keeps getting worse and worse and worse, which at the time he was speaking, it looked like it may have. Hopefully in the end it won't be as bad as we once thought. But, you know, Mike said, hey, if it gets a lot worse, I'll just get out. And I don't blame him one bit.
My favorite line from the whole story, though, is, and I guess, you know, showing off his eighth grade education. Walker said, I'm not worried about what somebody from Chicago or Illinois thinks. I'm worried about what taxpayers of Wisconsin think. Just a little help here, Scott. Just a little help. Chicago is in Illinois. Chicago's a city. It's in the state of Wisconsin. Just a little help. Just a little help. I'm being a good guy. You know, occasionally I do that to help out my buddy Scott. Anyway, the trademarked one, trademarks for Sarah and Bristol Palin are moving, you know, steaming right along as planned. So I am kind of wondering what's going to happen, how we're going to have to address them in the future, as the people formerly known as Palin. She was in Wisconsin over the weekend. And the reality is some of the news reports that I had heard back, it was like, you know, like 5-10 to 1 of people who were against her. There were a couple, maybe 1,000 tea twizzlers and several thousand people who really didn't want her there. So it was, I guess it was kind of interesting. You watch some of the clips and you really don't hear her. You hear a lot of booing. A lot of booing. Not much of her. But anyway, according to the Wisconsin Sentinel Journal, our quitter governor expressed her support for Scott Walker, which was what she was paid to go there and do, I'm sure, and supported his plans to limit the rights of Wisconsin workers to unionize in the public sector, and urged union members to stop fighting. Stop fighting his plan. He needs to help the budget. She said, hey, folks, he's trying to save your jobs and pensions. And to be honest, most of the people didn't go along with her, but she did pay for a really good one-liner, and I got to give her credit. I'd love to know her one-liner author. She said, quote, we're flat broke, but Obama thinks these solar shingles and that really fast trains will magically save us. So now he's shouting, all aboard the bullet train to bankruptcy. Boy, that's a good one.
Ooh, for
that's
her, for her.
She didn't think that up.
I'm sure she didn't.
Come on.
That's above her pay grade.
She didn't think that up. And then she went on to cite the University of Wisconsin's national championship women's hockey team, saying that congressional Republicans should learn to fight like a girl. Yeah, learn to fight like a girl.
Whatever that means.
I would love to, now I would wish somebody would go to that hockey team and say, you know, how many of you support her? I wonder that. Probably not very many. Anyway, on the 2012 Republican campaign trail, it appears that Ron Paul has won another straw poll. He has in a key South Carolina county, he has won another these ridiculous, nonsensical, half-baked, tiny little straw polls, but he's won another one. So good for him. He has raised nearly $3 million in the first quarter of 2011 through his PAC. He raised another $1 million through the Liberty PAC. So he's got a boatload of money.
Well, he also said today, just today, in fact, it was maybe a half hour before I left, saw an interview today, and they asked him about voting to, you know, lift the cap on spending. And he said, there'd have to be some very specific things in there, and I will not support it. Wow. I mean,
let's ask him next quarter.
Getting on his knees to the right wing, you know what I mean?
Let's see how he does next quarter. And Michelle Bachman, she has also done some prolific fundraising, $2.2 million in the first 3 months. She has outpaced Mitt Romney. It's Ron Paul and it's Michelle Bachman who have filled their coffers. She's got big bucks. She's got about $2.8 million on hand, which should make her, a formidable opponent, which I'm happy for. I love crazy. So it's good to see crazy with a whole bunch of money. But, you know, you look at all of this money that's gone into these elections of these really, really way out kooky kind of candidates. And you go, couldn't we put that money to better use? I think we could. And I look at Donald Trump and all the money that he's spending. And he hasn't officially said he's running because he can't. He's got to do his whole you're fired thing. But the guy did an interesting, pulled together some interesting quotes of top 10 reasons why conservatives should hate him. And, you know, it's probably, you know, stuff that's going to come up during the campaign. So he might as well get used to this. One of them, he said on CNN back in 2004, he said, quote, I probably identify more as a Democrat, which not going to go well with the conservatives. He says, I've been around for a long time and it just seems that the economy does better under Democrats than under Republicans. In 2007, he wrote to Nancy Pelosi saying, you're the best. Congrats, Donald. In 2007, he called Bush probably the worst president in the history of the United States. In 99, he said, I'm totally pro-choice. Also in 99, he said, I want to see the abortion issue removed from politics. I believe it's a personal decision that should be left to a woman and her doctor. Not going to go well with the radical right. In 99 on Larry King, he went on to say, I'm very liberal when it comes to health care. I believe in universal health care, which will, you know, give him a leg up on Romney, you think? Not going to happen. In his book, The America We Deserve, January 2000, he wrote, quote, the Canadian plan also helps Canadians live longer and healthier than Americans. We need, as a nation, to reexamine the single-payer plan. Not going to do very well to help his election campaign. Also, in his book, he wrote, by imposing a one-time 14.25% net worth tax on the richest individuals and trusts, we can put America on a found and a sound financial footing for the next century. In 2008, he said, I think Obama has a chance to go down as a great president. So, basically, he's sunk. The whole birther thing may help for a little bit, but those quotes are going to come up again and again and again. One of our last things for the presidential 2012 season. Remember the guy who had the big granite stone of the Ten Commandments at the Alabama courthouse? And he was removed from the Supreme Court of Alabama by an ethics panel because he wouldn't take it out. Well, he says he's ready to join the 2012 race. Former Judge Roy Moore, he's going to run as a Republican for president. He said he thinks it's about time to get God back into politics. Jesus is going to run for vice president. And says he's going to go and undo the Constitution. He's going to change the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. They're going to be the first 10 commandments. Very simple. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. VBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call VBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call VBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it when you have it.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come on, you got to work.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, I love this, talking about the Tea Party movement, basically calling them the surge protector for the GOP. You know, we got our surge protector. And I'm going, Does that mean you got a bunch of idiots who are willing to hold on to the negative and positive and take the voltage, take the hit for you, take the shock, which is going to be hunger, starvation, unemployment, homelessness, and basically working until you die? Or am I missing something? You know, that's kind of the way I see the Republican vision of America, which, you know, yesterday wasn't on the air, but yesterday the Supreme Court back in 1905 upheld the New York, the maximum. Boy, I'm going to lose my mind here. 1905 yesterday, the new Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act was unconstitutional. And it's what they used for years to shoot down all maximum hour, all minimum wage laws, anything having to do with making workers' lives better. It's what they used to shoot all that down, basically citing this idea of liberty of contract. This idea that, you know, Jake, you make a contract with your employer, and that's between the two of you, and we, society, has no say in that. So if you're willing to work for a buck an hour, you're going to work for a buck an hour. If you're willing to work in the most dangerous of conditions, you're willing to work in the most dangerous of conditions. If you're willing to be sexually harassed or offer your wife for, you know, payment for you to keep the job, whatever, that's liberty of contract. That's your contract between you and your employer. If your employer puts a piece of paper in front of you and says, sign this piece of paper saying that you'll never join a union and you'll never participate in a union, and if you do, you're fired, that's between you and your employer. This is the kind of stuff that went on, and this is where they want to take us back to this idea of liberty of contract. You know, basically saying that, you know what? Government has no responsibility. Government has no say in the private dealings of the employer and the employee, or, you know, the master and the serf. Which, again, you know, you go back to and you look through the history of our country and realize that that power is so unequal, that power in the hands of such a small number of people is so badly abused. I mean, I have a very difficult time dealing with people who seem to say, I'll make my own deal. And, you know, I used to think, yeah, go ahead. You're going to make a crappy deal. And, you know, shame on you. But the reality is it's tearing all of us down with them. I mean, that's the part that gets me.
I've met a lot of people like that. You've met a lot of people like that. And invariably, Rick, those are not the kind of people that are involved in your union or have very much experience with the union. They're people who seem to be inordinately concerned with just them. And in fact, the union is we and us. But when you have individuals who don't understand that, no, I can understand their ideas. It's unfortunate, but the labor movement has always had people like that.
Yeah, so liberty of contract seems to be the idea. Now think about this now. Borders Books is in big trouble. They're closing stores at a rapid pace. They're dumping employees at a rapid pace. Their stocks are falling. They're heading for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Everything is heading downward. They're spiraling quickly. So I look at this AP story, which just grabbed my attention. Borders wants to pay as much as $8.3 million in bonuses to executives and board members to keep them from leaving. Now, these are the people who drove you into this mess. These are the folks who drove the car down the road, said everything's going fine, everything's going fine, and then, holy crap, we're crash! That's kind of how I see the whole Borders thing. You knew this was coming for years. You knew it was coming for a long time. They did nothing to change things. Now we're going to pay $8.3 million to keep the people who did nothing, got you into this mess, and we're going to can a whole bunch of workers. Is that kind of how we're getting that's how it is. What Borders is saying, though, is they're going, well, look, you know, we need emergency reorganization. Now it's a crisis. We need an emergency. So in a crisis, the only way we can keep people is we give them a boatload of money. Because, of course, they know the ship's sinking. They're losing 25 executives already have jumped ship for somewhere else because they know they've tanked this. It's a done deal. So the shareholders, I think the shareholders should be upset in this. I know the workers should be upset in this. But at the end of the day, you know that they're going to get their big bonuses for just hanging around a little bit longer. But again, you know, it goes back to this we need these very bright executives because they're so intelligent and they're so much smarter than the rest of us. You know, I could have told you Borders was on a downward trek a couple of years ago. And they should have known that, but they did nothing. They did nothing. And yet you're going to keep them around. You're going to reward failure for what? Because we need smart executives. And we couldn't possibly find anyone as smart as they are. We can't possibly find anybody that smart. We're running out of smart people. And again, I guess this could be an argument to why we shouldn't be cutting $1 billion from K-12 education, why we shouldn't be cutting 56% from the higher education budget, because evidently, according to Borders, we are running out of smart people. Because there are only a handful of very smart executives who need to be heaped with all of this wealth. They need all of this money. Why? To stay and clean up the mess that they created. Are you kidding me? Really? I mean, if anyone could give me a rational explanation why these guys need to get all these bonuses, I'm dying to hear it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, because I can't come up with anything. I'm sorry. I'm completely lost on this one. Completely lost. And you look at the fact that in Sunday's newspaper, right there on the front page of the review and opinion page, the headline read, "There aren't enough cookies in Pennsylvania." And basically what it's talking about is, you know, our governor, Tom Corporate, his scorched earth education plan, you know, all the spending and turn Pennsylvania into an at-will education state. You know, you can get an education at your will to pay for it. An at-will education state. I mean, we were already in an at-will employment state. Might as well go to education as well. And you know, the rest of you who can't afford it, who don't have the will because you're broke, we always need hand laborers. We're always going to need people to sweep the streets. Always going to need people to clean up the mess. Well, on April 25th, from 10 a.m. to noon here in Harrisburg at the Capitol, a group of teachers, mothers, and other concerned citizens are holding a giant bake sale for education. That's right. We could do it during the Bush years for armor plating and for flak jackets. Now during the Corbett years, it's bake sales for education. We're going to make up $1 billion of bake sale money. $1 billion. Do you think there are enough cookies in Pennsylvania to make $1 billion to fund education properly? Not in little baggies. We're absolutely going to need to, do some rational stuff that our governor has said today never going to happen, never going to tax the drillers, never going to close the Delaware loophole. Tell me what sense that makes, because I'm missing the point. I'm really, if there's any rational Republican out there who's got a good explanation, again, I'm asking for it, because, you know, I've yet to meet you face to face. I've asked tons of people, explain this to me. I've asked tons of conservatives, explain this to me. Conservatism is about conserving institution. The institution of education is worth saving. It's worth conserving. But evidently, we don't have a governor who thinks that we should be doing that. We've got a governor who, for one reason or another, has decided that all of the money that corporations allow to flow out of the state is just fine and dandy. All of the stuff that comes bubbling up from the ground, free and clear. I'm having a real difficult time with that, folks. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've got a rational explanation, I'm all ears. We're right back after this. Oh,
Smith Show.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you are rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Thought-provoking,
intelligent conversation
with a heart.
The voice of the working class,
Rick Smith.
We have fed you all for 1,000 years, and you ail us still unfed. And though there's never a dollar of all your wealth, but mark the workers dead. We have yielded our best to give you rest. And you lie on a crimson wall. That would be the price of all your wealth. A good God, we have paid in full.
Well, you know, it was today. Today, back in 1908, the IWW poem for We Have Fed You All for 1,000 Years. And you go back and you look at this. The reality is, you know, for all these years, for eternity almost, the working people have really, with their blood, their sweat, their tears, their backbreak, have supported those who basically were born into privilege or figured out how to exploit. It's an excellent song. Also today, back in 1912, the National Guard was called out against striking West Virginia coal miners. This is one of the most violent strikes in the history of the country. The mine workers were demanding to be paid the same as other area miners and have their union recognized. You know what the state did? Sent out the National Guard. Dropped bombs on them. Shot and killed people for what? Because they wanted a better tomorrow. And here we are. Here we are talking about collective bargaining as if it's something that, something we could do without. Oh, we're so much better than that. Oh, we're so much better. We don't need that anymore. That was something for the old days. Something for the old days. And I read a really interesting quote in one of the West Virginia newspapers by a guy named Carl Hostler. And I think he's right on that head. He said, quote, "I see much irony in the public view of collective bargaining. The most successful unions in the country are the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, and other business groups." He says the whole idea of a union is not that complicated. They want to get the best deal they can for their members. When business associations band together to get the best deals, we call it capitalism. When working people band together to try and get a good deal for themselves, many call it socialism. And I think that really, in and of itself, really lays it all out in pretty stark detail. The reality is, you know, I know people who say, well, the Chamber of Commerce is great. It's a union. Basically what it is, it's a group of people who've come together. Why? Make their lot in life better. Why is it then when capital comes together and forms a corporation, we seem to be perfectly fine with that? In fact, we've even heaped on them all of these rights that they never had before. We're saying, here, you're now a person. Congratulations. You have unlimited free speech rights. With money, of course. Spend all the money you want. And they did, man. And they spent, and they spent, and they spent. And what's amazing to me is nobody asked, where are all these attack ads coming from? Where are all of these negative ads coming from? I mean, Sestax, I don't think there was anybody who took as many negative ads from people nobody could identify than Joe Sestax. And look what we got. We got Senator Toomey.
Karl Rove and his group sent a lot of money into this state.
Yeah, and it's people like the Koch brothers who have now come up with a website and a front group to go and attack all of the people who are saying it's the Koch brothers funding all of this stuff. Look who's behind the curtain. So they're spending a boatload of money putting out these attack groups, and then they're spending a boatload of money defending those attack groups from people who are pointing out the fact that they're attack groups who are really lying. It's BS. All in the hopes that somehow we're going to hoodwink the American people into believing what is unbelievable. And that is that the billionaire class in this country gives a rat's behind about workers, gives a rat's behind about this country. What they care about are profit. What they care about are making more money, which is why we see most of the job creation that's gone on from these tax handouts have happened overseas, not here. If these were true patriotic billionaire Americans, they'd be creating jobs here during the recession, saying, okay, well, you know what? I'm going to take some of my billions and build a bridge. We don't see that, do you? You don't see the tax handouts building bridges or roads. Don't see that. What we see is the bridge going straight out of the creek, taking the money with it. That's what we see. And speaking of capitalism, a study released on Friday says that General Motors received the most clean energy patents in the past year. According to reports, GM's 135 patents represents nearly 14% of the nearly 1,900 U.S. patents obtained by 700 organizations in 2010, according to analysis done by the Clean Energy Patent Growth Index. So basically what you've got GM who's saying, all right, well, we need to reinvent ourselves. They've got some patents that covered hybrid vehicles. They've got, you know, fuel cells, solar energy. They got a bunch of patents out there because they got to figure out, you know, what are we going to do from here? How are we going to make a bunch of money? In fact, one of their vice presidents said, quote, GM is on a journey to reinvent the automotive DNA, and that's driving a great amount of innovation and technical breakthroughs. He said, we will continue our aggressive focus on advanced propulsion techniques that will benefit our customers and the environment. GM received a total of 940 patents in 2010. That puts them in the top 25 companies. Now, if we can only get GM to go over to India and say, hey, you know, instead of paying those people 47 cents an hour doing back-breaking, you know, work where they're having major spinal injuries and major injuries, they're out on the picket lines. The Chamber of Commerce over there is saying, government, put them back to work. Why not have GM go over and do something about it? That would be nice, don't you think, Jake?
Or better yet, move those jobs back to the United States.
Oh, see? Now you're thinking. Patriotic American corporation. Not going to happen. Speaking of alternative energy, the city of Los Angeles, their city council president, Jan Perry, has this really bizarre, crazy, stupid idea. You know, maybe, you know, do what the Germans did, you know, 20 years ago. You know, what made them the leading producer of solar power in the world, you know. You know, maybe use some of that money that the federal government has, maybe some of that money that the state has to kind of put solar panels on all the rooftops on all the commercial buildings and all the multi-family dwellings, you know, like the apartment buildings. Maybe think about it. Might put some people back to work, create an industry of building solar panels. May actually save the city some money. May actually save some of the folks who live in low-income housing, for instance, some money. And that might actually free some of that money up to go into the economy or maybe into education. You know, maybe an idea. Nah, never mind. Not going to work. Couldn't possibly work. Too crazy of an idea. It's never been done before. In the U.S., that is. Worked pretty well in Germany. In fact, it's working pretty well in China, evidently, because they're spending boatloads of money on alternative energy, on wind and solar and all of that stuff. You know what I think is interesting, though, with the Los Angeles thing and why I don't think it's ever going to work? You know, because Los Angeles has all that sun. And solar power couldn't possibly work in a place that has all that sun. Because like Germany, for instance, they've got one of the fewest number of sunny days in the country, in the world. And yet they've got solar panels everywhere, and somehow it works for them. But on a sunny place like Los Angeles, it couldn't possibly work, could it? You know, one of those places that has sun around all the time.
You would think it would be ideal.
You know, what they should do is they should move them into that place that it's sunny 24 hours a day in Alaska. You know, move them in there for, you know, some time of the year. Get all the sun, then move them out. Take them somewhere else. But no, we can't have smart policy. We can't possibly have something that would actually work.
You know, you would think, with all the technology today, all kidding aside, Rick, they'd be able to adapt to that idea.
They don't want it. I mean, you know, there's so many people lobbying against this stuff, and this is what gets me. You know, I get into conversations with some of my conservative nitwit friends, and, you know, all you want to do is subsidize solar. Hey, dingus, at the end of the road, we're still dependent on oil and foreign companies, countries to give it to us. At some point, don't you want to think about being independent? I'm of the mindset that we could be energy independent within 10 years. If all we said is, look, from now on, every house that's built has to be energy independent. Sorry, I was just reading in the paper. People built a house. They're going to use 20% of the energy that any other house uses because they did some smart things. And it only cost them about 15% more to build their house. So they're going to use 20% of the electricity they would have under the current building codes by just doing some smart stuff, and it just increased their bill by 15%. If you have that as a policy across the board, I guarantee that 15% gets cut in half and eventually just is done away with because everybody's doing it. There's a demand for it. There's a need for it. But, you know, we don't think that way. We don't think about smart policy. We think about the tip of our nose. That's it. You know, we're very Pavlovian. It's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing how short-sighted as a nation we have become, how visionless our leaders are. On both sides of the aisle, you don't hear Democrats coming out here with big ideas. When was the last time you heard a really big idea coming out of a politician? Our friend Mike Fedor, running for Cumberland County commissioner, said we'd like to have a train come from Carlisle to Harrisburg. That's a really big idea for this area. I mean, and it stops people in their tracks. Oh my God. A vision, a thought. Oh, what do we do? The whole process just stops when somebody has an idea.
He actually has it planned out. He can tell you the cost.
Amazing. We're right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Oversight and Government Reforms held a hearing on state and municipal debt. Tough choices ahead. They called on two governors with diametrically opposed management styles to testify. Governor Pat Shumlin of Vermont and Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin. Shumlin is of the mind that unions serve a purpose in negotiations, while Walker sees them as an impediment to government's functioning.
Schumlin told Walker that if his goal is to strip employees of collective bargaining rights, he should just come out and say it. He told the Wisconsin governor not to hide behind a drummed-up budget crisis.
What Vermonters are looking for and what they expect is the same thing that they expect in Wisconsin and the same thing they wish for and expect in America. They want reasonableness. They want compromise. They want bright people working together to solve problems. And when you use vinegar, when you refuse to meet with unions, when you don't sit down and talk with them, when you take on an outright assault on a basic principle in a democratic society, which is collective bargaining, the thing that my grandfather, when he got off the boat, and others now rely on and relied on to make a decent living, to come from a beet farmer to success in America, the thing that built our country, well, that's a different debate.
Walker argued that collective bargaining isn't a right as defined by the Constitution.
No, because I believe fundamentally, if what we've heard said over and over again was a fundamental right, you all in Congress would be acting on it right now. You do not have collective bargaining other than Postal Service workers for the vast majority of public employees who work for the federal government for wages and for benefits. If it's a fundamental right, why aren't you debating it right here now? It's not. It's a government entitlement. Collective bargaining is important for the private sector. For the examples we've heard about the impact it's had on families and legacies, private sector unions are my partner in economic development. I work with them, and I hope to work with our public employees.
Okay.
But collective bargaining itself is not a fundamental right. Rights come from the Constitution, and nowhere in the Constitution does that clearly define that.
During the hearing, Walker admitted that he hadn't campaigned on stripping collective bargaining, but he added that state employees shouldn't have been surprised by his move.
No, and I'd say no, because for 8 years as county executive, I not only talked about it, I actually brought it up. I did what was called a reality tour, where I talked about the challenges that we were unsustainable and that collective bargaining was driving that.
When asked if Wisconsin teachers are overpaid, Walker said if the state moved to a merit-based system, he would even consider paying teachers more.
If we could set up a system where we rewarded based on performance and merit, I'd even be willing to pay more.
Well,
but we don't have that system right now. We have one solely based on seniority.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You helped to turn America blue. Now let's keep it that way. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our friends in the Tea Party love to say, well, you know, we're not racist. We just don't like black people. That's not true. That's not what they say. What they say is they do something like this woman in Orange County has done. Her name is Marilyn Davenport, and she's an elected member of the Orange County Republican Party. What she did is she took a copy of Three Monkeys and photoshopped President Obama's face into one of the pansies' bodies. And she basically said, you know, I'm not a racist. No, come on. You know, who could possibly do that? Everyone's I'm not a racist. It's a joke. Come on. It's funny. I have friends that are black. I have friends who happen to be black, she says. Besides, I only sent it to a few people, mostly people I didn't think would be upset by it. You know, like my other racist friends. You know, I look at this and I go, really? Are we still doing this? And are we still going, oh, I didn't think it was racist. No, we've established this. If you put his face on a monkey's body, you are basically, no, not basically, you are a racist. It's that simple, Jake. There's nothing to it.
It harkens back to the time when blacks were considered less than human. It's that simple.
Well, come on.
How can you not know that?
It's funny.
No, how can you not know that? Oh, and the arrogance of her. Now she must think the public's stupid. She's going to make a joke out of it, and she didn't offer to resign. I mean, she didn't even have enough common sense to do that. I guess she figures she can still get reelected. And you know what? Maybe she can. And shame on those people if they allow it.
I thought it was funny that, you know, that she says that, you know, I only sent it to a few people. You know, the people I didn't think would be upset by it. You know, like my other racist friends. I mean, really. I mean, come
on. She just indicted herself. She's telling the public now she thinks it is funny. Mm.
But, you know, at the end of all of this, you know, you go back and you look at all of the things that have gone on since Obama announced that he was running. And it really, to me, has opened up my eyes to something, you know, a couple of friends that I've had throughout the years have said, who said, you know, racism is alive and well in this
country.
It's
just below the surface.
And as my one older friend said, he goes, look, you know, I think I preferred it back when they would call me a name.
He was overt.
And it was out in the public, and you knew who the a-holes were. And you knew who your enemies were. He said, you know, too often, you know, you got people who are smiling at you while they're stabbing you in the back. And, you know, there's part of me that says, you know what, I want to know what her position is. And we shouldn't ask her to leave. We know now she's a racist, and we know what the party stands for since they continue to elect her. So, you know, for me, I'm okay with that, I think. I think I'm getting to the point where I'm more okay with it. Not that it matters to me. I don't know that anyone will impose my head on the body of a chimpanzee. I don't know that would be all that funny. Maybe a sumo wrestler. I don't know. But you wouldn't have to impose. See, I beat you to that.
I can just, well, never mind.
But, you know, the reality of this is, you know, I look at it and I go back to some conversations I've had with some friends who've said, look, it was, you know, it was bad, but at least we knew. At least you knew who your kids were playing with. At least you knew what you were getting in, who you were working with, and you could adjust accordingly. And there's part of me that thinks maybe we take the stigma off of the racist words, and we just allow the scumbags to be scumbags, and you know who they are, and you have the ability to associate with them or not to associate with them. There's part of me that thinks that. And, you know, there are going to be some Confederate flag waving Southern congressmen in there using the N-word on the floor of the House. And, you know, maybe we go back to the days of when I was a kid. You know, a couple meet them out in the back of the yard and, you know, teach them a lesson, make a citizen out of them. You know, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to this is. But when someone who's in an elected position says, well, gee, you know, I didn't see anything wrong with it. I only sent it to a few of my friends who wouldn't be offended by it. That to me really, really strikes of elitism, of just, you know, what kind of country have we become? It makes me think, and it frustrates me, because you would think after all these years, we would be over it. And you look down in Mississippi, where they, what was it, 45% said that interracial marriage should be illegal, people should go to jail. I mean, really? In the poorest state in the country, you've got nothing else to worry about? You don't have to worry about health care. You don't have to worry about food. You don't have to worry about going to work. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. You got time to worry about whether two people are going to get married. I mean, that, to me, on the bigger scale, you know, my grandfather always used to say, you know, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. You got your own problems. And the more I look at it, the more that, again, more sound reasoning. And I try not to worry about anybody else. I worry about myself. I take care of my family, which I think most people do. But when you start looking at laws restricting what consenting adults can do within the four walls, the confines of their four walls, when you start talking about what people can think and feel, and it's scary stuff. And now we've got this technology. We've got this ability to really get inside people's minds. I mean, we are headed down a really, really dangerous path with these folks who are just nuts leading the way. I mean, we got some crazy people leading the way.
Well, this lady, you know, our county, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's a pretty affluent area, which just mystifies me even more. There's a lot of people in that county that are well-educated and they understand the implications. And why aren't they speaking out, demanding her resignation? It's not a matter of Republican, Democrat. It's a matter of human decency.
And going along those lines, the lines of worrying about yourself, I saw this story in the Pioneer Press out from Minnesota area. And it talks about St. Paul, Minnesota, where they have these things called wet houses. Have you ever heard of a wet house?
Can't say I have.
Other than, you know, what we've had here recently with all the flooding that's been going on. Evidently, these wet houses that they've got all around, I guess they've got four of them in Minneapolis, St. Paul, according to the article, are where people who are, you know, basically alcoholics or drug addicts or whatever you know, whatever their vice is, where they go and they drink and or do whatever it is that they do until they die. And what they're saying is, look, you got a bunch of people like this one guy that they point out. He's been drinking for 39 years. He's had every lecture you can imagine. He's had people pray for him. He's been punished. And despite all that, you know, he's been homeless. He's had six DUIs. He's been through alcohol treatment six times, been to, you know, the jail time after time after time again. And he's 54 years old, and there's only one thing he's ever done and done well, and that's drinking. So they've basically set up these houses where people like this guy can go, do whatever you got to do, and you're out of trouble. And you're just going to be warehoused there in your 12 by 12 concrete little apartment. It's more of a cell, but and you can do whatever you want. And he said, you know, I drink until I kill the day off. And that's his thing. They say it costs about $18,000 per person to have one of these wet houses, as opposed to the $40,000 for incarceration or for alcohol rehab treatment. And, you know, you look at some of this stuff and you go, you know, with budgets being the way they are, is locking up a guy who's, you know, who's drinking and driving or who's, you know, public intoxication, is that really a smart way to use public resources? I don't know. Then again, you know, part of me doesn't like the idea, but there's part of me. And I had a really a distant, far off, distant relative who, you know, he was hopeless, just beyond hopeless. Every time he turned around, he was getting arrested for public intoxication. He got two jaywalking tickets after being hit by cars for walking across the street because they had to give him a ticket to protect the driver. You know, eventually he was going to get killed or he was going to kill somebody or he was going to end up in jail or dead. And I always said, you know, maybe what we should just do is have a place to warehouse him, let him do what he wants to do until eventually he kicks off. And maybe a smart person, a good capitalist, could take out some life insurance on him and get the payoff.
Well, I mean, the truth is, you know, you send these people to class to rehabilitate themselves. It's not going to work unless they want it. You can send them to all the classes you want. And a lot of times they'll go just because it's a condition of them being released. But if they're really not sincere, if they really don't want, at the end of the day, they have to decide to change. It's that simple.
Yeah, back in 1991, I did something really stupid.
Imagine that.
Well, I like we were talking about the other day. You know, I drinking and driving was almost a sport when we were younger. I was coming back from playing a gig, you know, on the east side, and I'd had my customary fifth of Tanqueray. And I was driving home, and I got stopped and ended up going for, you know, long story short, DUI, all that stuff. And I had to go to this weekend class, just like this kind of thing, this rehab class, where basically the whole purpose of this weekend away in the hotel was to see that if you could sit for a whole weekend without jonesing and without freaking out. And it was amazing to me how many people could not sit through that Friday through Sunday afternoon little boring presentation.
It was a detox test.
All it was you sit there, watch videos, and listen to boring lectures. And there were people who were taken out, you know, going off to either rehab or jail or both or who knows. But I was really amazed by that. And I wondered, you know, to be honest, you know, there's a couple of people that I met there who, you know, I wonder how many times in the future they were going to get nailed for this. And because they were habitual. They had been through other programs. They had been through this over and over and over. So it's an interesting thought, interesting concept. One I don't know that I'm going to advocate, but it's an interesting thought. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith. The
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
So much fanfare, so little fare. And once you see it without the dazzling neon lights rippling across it, you won't be a fan. Unless you're a millionaire corporate executive. It is the highly ballyhooed Republican budget proposal. It was unleashed on us a few days ago in a high-voltage press conference by Paul Ryan, the GOP's wonky ideologue who now chairs the House Budget Committee. Ryan dubbed his plan, ta-ta-ta-ta, Path to Prosperity. And indeed it is. But prosperity for whom? That is the core question that should be asked about all prosperity claims. Ryan's budgetary offering turns out to be deja voodoo all over again. Two-thirds of the $4 trillion in budget cuts in his proposal comes out of the hides of the middle class and the poor. Take Medicare, which Ryan does. He would defund and privatize this effective, efficient, and wildly popular program of universal health care for seniors, replacing it with insurance vouchers that put seniors at the mercy of profiteering health care vultures. The vouchers would be worth about a third of what Medicare covers, so goodbye and good luck, old folks. But health care coverage is not all that Ryan's Republican prosperity plan cuts. The rich and corporations, poor babies, need another break, and the chairman delivers. Rather than paying a 35% tax rate on their fabulous incomes, Ryan generously cuts their rate to 25%, less than common working stiffs must pay. After all, promises the GOP's new voodoo priest, this governmental giveaway to those at the top would naturally tinkle down to the masses, generating prosperity for every American, just as it did in the reign of George W.'s presidency. You remember those golden years, don't you? This is Jim Hightower saying, as we say in Texas, never sign nothing by neon.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. Believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Yeah, that's an interesting statement. You know, just lock people up. The latest Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development report just released says that the United States imprisons 760 people out of every 100,000. That is by far the most in any country in the world. Second place, South Africa, who has a prison population 329 out of every 100,000. So you're looking at twice as many people we're locking up than South Africa per 100,000 people. The average is 140. So while the rest of the world, and now stop and think about the money that goes into this, Jake, the rest of the world is locking up about 140 every 100,000 people. Because those are criminals. Those are the people who are breaking into people's houses or putting guns in your face or doing a lot of the really violent stuff that you really have to put people away for. Yet here in the U.S., where we have a very for-profit prison system, where there's a profit motive attached to harsher sentencing, longer sentencing, three strikes and you're out, 760 out of 100,000. And what that means big profit for somebody, but what it also means is that social spending that we could be spending on education, that we could be spending on job training and health care and all kinds of things, we're handing off the profiteers to warehouse people in prisons. And it doesn't really make any sense to me on a rational plane. But when you stop and go back and you look at the fact that we are a country that's run by investors, the investor class owns this country. They own this place. And it's all about maximizing shareholder wealth. Because that's what the CEO's job is. His job is solely to maximize shareholder wealth, which is why I've always thought it's weird that you have a president and CEO as the same guy, because they really have two very different goals. I mean, the positions for each of them are very different, which I've always thought it was bizarre that you'd have a guy that you would entrust the power of both positions to one person. Which, you know, the CEO, his job, obviously, maximize shareholder wealth. That's all his job is. Make sure the shareholders get as much money as they can load into their pockets. The president's job is to actually run the business, actually make sure the wheels are turning and the company's long-term viable. So on one hand, you've got a guy who's looking at the next 15 minutes and another guy who's looking 5 years down the road. I don't know how one person can do both. Makes no sense to me. But, hey, welcome to America. That's what we do. And we do it for a lot of profit. Because, like Borders, the people who are looking 15 minutes into the future, we're supposed to be in charge of looking down the road. We need to give them $8.3 million in bonuses because nobody else can fix this company that they obviously destroyed, because nobody else knows the business as well as these guys who destroyed. Does that seem logical to you?
No.
On any level?
You know, there's something wrong with our values, Rick, when we're spending more and a lot more on prisons than we are on education. We have it. It's convoluted. You should be spending more at the beginning of their life to maybe try to keep those children out, don't you think? Somewhere our thinking just isn't. And then we get into nonviolent offenses. We got people serving. Well, you remember going back a couple of 10 years ago, was this rage, three offenses and done? Was it drugs?
The Clinton years. Three strikes and you're out.
Three strikes and you're out. I think it was mandatory. Was it 30 or 40 years? Well, that's crazy.
But it's a lot of profit.
And it could be, and the sad part about it is it could have been a minor, relatively minor drug offense. For 30 years, we got to take care of them? Are you kidding me? And a lot of that was politically motivated. It was pushed by politicians.
Oh, do you think?
Politicians who, you know,
and wanted to
look good, or by district attorneys who, many district attorneys use that to go on to bigger and better things. Oh, I don't know, U.S. Senate, governors of states. You check the background of many of the people in public office. A lot of them came from law enforcement district attorneys.
Where'd your buddy Arlen come from?
He was a district attorney.
That's right.
Philadelphia. Well,
where'd Tom Corporate come from?
Attorney General, but I'm sure he was a district attorney in his home county.
You know, at the end of this, what you've got is this really highlights the fact that we as a society have politicians who have no real vision. All they worry about is getting elected. And you look at the reality. Nobody wants to say that they're weak on crime. Nobody wants to say that, you know what, we have bizarre sentencing standards. We should be talking about rehabilitation instead of what Americans love, which is retribution and payback. Look, to be honest, I'm as payback as anybody. I'm as old school, go back on your butt as anybody. But the reality is most of the people who are in jail are not violent offenders. That's the unfortunate part of this. And we could easily have sane, rational sentencing requirements that wouldn't cost you and me, the taxpayers, 40 grand a year to house these people. I mean, 40 grand a year is more than it costs to send people to college. But no, we can't do that. Oh, no. And what bothers me is, you know, you can go to jail and you got health care. I go to work at some crummy job, I might not have health care. And you look at the fact that the U.S. spends 16% of its GDP on health costs, on giving over to for-profit institutions and not covering everybody. It should be criminal. The most money spent in the world on health care, and we've got some of the worst outcomes. And when you look at the second-place person, the second-place country, those Frenchies, you know, the people who we won't eat their fries anymore, we only eat freedom fries. They spend just over 11% and have some of the best outcomes and cover everybody. So what it's telling me is, look, we don't have a spending problem. We have an allocation problem. We have a resource problem in how we allocate those resources. And it bothers me when you hear people just going, well, we need, it's not working, we need to cut it. No, I think we need to do some smart stuff. The problem is look, maybe we are running out of educated people. Maybe we are running out of critical thinkers. You know, I think of my grandfather quite often. Not educationally, someone who had credentials. Only went to the eighth grade. But he was a smart guy. He had street smarts. He had common sense. Too often what we think of as smart is somebody read it in a book and they don't know how to apply it. We don't teach critical thinking anymore. And that's what frightens me, that we're going to end up with a whole bunch of people who, well, technically I know how to do it, but I've never actually done it. You know, I read about brain surgery in a book once. No, I want a brain surgeon who's actually tried it a couple of times, you know, done a little tinkering on cadavers, you know, done some actual work, you know, maybe trained a little bit. I don't want somebody who just read it in a book, read it on Wikipedia. That would kind of bother me. When that guy cut into your neck, you know, to do that surgery to roto-root out your vein there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want a guy who read about it on Wikipedia, or you want somebody who actually knew what the hell he was doing?
No, he was very, very, very well qualified. In fact, the irony is, Rick, maybe we talked about that. Well, I know we did. You might have forgotten it. This guy had worked in the British system for years, by the way, and was very effusive with praise. But, you know, we don't. The teabaggers don't want to hear that.
Well, you know what the teabaggers want to hear? Glenn Beck is leaving New York City. That's right. It's really just, it's heartbreaking for the people of New York. You know, there's a collective, well, I'm sure there's, you know, there's a collective kind of, you know, just this, you know, this collective feeling of... Yeah, that's about it. In fact, I'm quite happy to hear he's going, personally. Anyway, he's saying you're not going to have me to kick around anymore. He's going to be offering, he's going off the TV there, I guess, and he's going to launch this new big site that he got, The Blaze, which is going to be radio, television, internet, all of it. He's going to be everywhere at once. He's going to be like the wind and the air and the sea all together. He says he's about to build a research department that will utilize the idle brains that we have. Retired CIA, military, PhDs. He says, as we build a new media, I'm not building it in New York. So he's going to build new media. And I'm sure the new media is going to be so new that nobody's going to pay attention. All I can say, and you know, I mean this, Glenn, from the bottom of my heart. On the news that you're leaving, all I can say is good. Bye. It's about it. To be honest, he brings nothing to the discussion. All it is finger pointing. All it is hatred. And going back to I'm sure he could come up with a defense for the woman who put the monkey face on the Obama face on the monkey. I'm sure he could possibly do that. And there are some puddle brains who would go right along with it.
No, he claimed that Obama hated white people. Hated white people.
You know, and that makes almost no sense.
And where he got that, I don't know.
Well, I know where he got it. Pulled it where he gets all his facts from.
He bent over and pulled out a good one.
Yeah, you know, pulled out one there. But I don't know why you would say Obama hated white people. White people gave him a whole bunch of money and made him president. I would love white people. I mean, it's me who hates white people most of the time. I've never been screwed over by a minority. I've never had someone give me, I've never gotten the shaft from a black person or a Hispanic or a Chinese person. It's always been whitey. It's always been a white guy with a white shirt on and a tie and a big smile. Hi, how you doing? Pleased to meet you. That's the guy who sticks it to me most often. A businessman.
Can you imagine that? Imagine that.
You know, that's the truth, though.
Remember the famous song, Smiling Faces?
No.
Knows no traces of the evil that lurks within.
Yeah, well, that's the end of it. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Showing the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The following message is brought to you by SEIU Local 668.
My name is Lewis. I help senior citizens get the services they need. I work for you, the taxpayers, in the Area Agency on Aid. Our senior population is growing. Their incomes are shrinking. Their need for government services is increasing, all at the same time. Funding for these services is not keeping pace, which means long waiting lists, huge caseloads, and more seniors at risk. We all know that these are tough economic times, but who wants to see our senior citizens suffer? They did their part. They worked hard and paid their taxes. Now it's our turn to make sure they get the services they need. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they respect our senior citizens and vote to increase funding for programs that protect them.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. I've got Victoria Jones on the line, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Delighted.
What's going on?
Well, we've got all kinds of things going on. Standard & Poor's rating services rocked Washington today when it announced it was lowering its outlook on U.S. debt from stable to negative, which basically means watch out. If you don't get your act together and do something about the deficit, we are going to downgrade you. So, of course, the markets immediately fell, and then all the politicians started responding.
Well, that had to make the Tea Party all tingly in the panties.
Well, it certainly did. The closest response I've got to a Tea Partier is Eric Cantor, who isn't quite one, but he says it means basically that the debt limit increase proposed by the White House must be accompanied by meaningful fiscal reforms that immediately reduce federal spending. And stop our nation from digging itself further into debt.
The Standards and Poor rating people, how political could this be? And aren't they the same people who missed the whole housing bubble thing?
They did miss the housing bubble. Generally speaking, they are not considered political. They're not generally considered to have a particular bias one way or the other. They're generally considered. Now, who knows?
But you see, the timing seems interesting.
Yeah, it does. I mean, they're generally considered to just call it as they see it.
So the Republicans have got their budget plan. What's Obama doing?
Obama is heading to the West Coast this week, Annandale, Virginia, tomorrow for a town hall meeting, which isn't very far west. But then he's going to San Francisco, Los Angeles. He's going to Facebook. And he is going to be really promoting his own deficit-cutting plan, which, as you know, of course, he gave a speech about last Wednesday. And really, he needs to link his position on reining in the debt to efforts to boost the economy. And he feels this is a tremendous opportunity. He feels this is the first time since he gave what many consider was a pretty feisty speech that was popular with the unions, popular with liberals, popular with Democratic voters, that he can go out there and really start laying the groundwork to pull back also some independents who he needs also for 2012, and also say to people, look, the House Republicans passed a budget last week, and basically it was rubbish.
Well, it is that time of the year. We're getting into the election season, so he's going to need something there. As are the other politicians going home for their town halls and their goings on. What do you see down that road?
Well, everybody's on recess for 2 weeks. It's the second longest recess of the year, and I think we're going to see town halls going on all across the country. Some of them may be doing them by phone, of course, if they're a bit nervous of what the people are going to be saying. But they're going to be having town halls both about the budget vote last week, in which the Republicans passed their budget in the House. Of course, the Senate Democrats don't have a budget yet. And also the debt ceiling vote, which is coming up in early May, really is the first time that it'll come up. And they can either vote on it then, which is unlikely because I don't think they'll be able to agree, or they can push it back. And the latest development on that, of course, is that South Carolina Republican Senator Jim DeMint has threatened to block any vote in Congress on raising the debt ceiling if he doesn't get a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, and he'll block it with a filibuster.
Oh, beautiful. Just what I would expect. What about the deficit commissions? What about that? What about the deficit town halls? What are we lining up there?
Well, in terms of the deficit town halls, basically, I mean, they will be, both sides will be saying, you know, our plan is better. I think that the Republicans are going to be saying, look, you know, we voted on this plan last week. This is great, and we're going to move forward. And in terms of Medicare, this is not a voucher system. And if you're 55 or under, we're giving you an opportunity to buy health insurance, and they're going to explain it. But if you're over 55, we're not touching it. And they're banking on the fact they believe that people 55 and under don't care about Medicare and will be happy to have a change. Democrats are banking on what they believe is the fact that they can sell this as throwing granny under a bus. And I actually am not sure that Democrats are right.
Well, I don't know that it's throwing granny under the bus. I think what it's going to do is that for some it's going to work and some it's not. I look at my grandmother, who's 82 years old. I don't see her getting insurance from anybody.
But it's not going to impact her, you see, because she's not 55 or under.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I'm going to be 82 at some point, I hope. And I may be in that exact same
you.
I may be in that exact same situation with a $15,000 voucher or whatever it is, not being able to afford to buy insurance in the private market, which is what they're basically selling,
yeah,
right?
That's right. And you are going to be impacted. And this is what now is starting to come out. And this is where the conversation is going to go. Are you going to be able to buy insurance in the private market? They're saying it's competitive. Well, it really isn't competitive. It's not competitive now. And what insurance company is going to be jumping up and down at the idea of taking on all these 55-year-old people?
Yeah, I've said since the beginning I started this program, I wish I could find a business model where all the risk was taken out. You look at the insurance industry. The sickest people are taken out, the very old, the very young, and the poor, all taken out. And then the private market can pick and choose among who they want.
Yeah.
Find me that industry. So what's our buddy Boehner up to?
With regard to which?
The Department of Justice in the Defense of Marriage Act.
Oh, well, yes, Defense of Marriage Act. Well, the White House said it's no longer going to defend DOMA. It says it's unconstitutional. Said that a couple of months ago. So today, Speaker Boehner. Very hard to get that name right.
Gotcha.
Some people think that he deliberately pronounces it that way. Sent a letter to Nancy Pelosi asking her to support a reallocation of funds from the Department of Justice to cover the defense of the statute. In other words, we are going to have to defend the Defense of Marriage Act ourselves in the House of Representatives, and we need cash from the Department of Justice. And Nancy Pelosi is very unlikely to say, oh, yeah, let's do this, because last month the House convened a special panel to consider mounting a defense of DOMA. It voted along party lines, 3-2. Pelosi voted no.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. And there are several cases involving DOMA, probably 10 separate cases, one that was supposed to be heard in federal court in New York today, and I have not yet heard any details on what happened in that case.
Well, we will look forward to that. And the Supreme Court ruling?
Supreme Court ruling, yeah. No action on Virginia's call for speedy review of the health care law. And we were expecting that today we would hear whether they were going to give them quicker review. In other words, leapfrogging over the federal courts of appeal. Maybe a justice asked to write a short opinion or for some time to think about it. We've no idea. They said nothing. They do meet again on Friday. We may get to know something by then, but we know nothing. People are really wringing their hands, wondering why did we not hear anything from them today, but they don't have to tell us why they don't do things.
Interesting, interesting. And the soon-to-be trademarked Sarah Palin, a new pack starting out?
Yeah, she's got a new website that launched today. This is interesting because she already has this Sarah Pack website, but this is a new, improved one. It's got a lot of content. It's got all kinds of features. You can donate online. It collects data about you. And when you look at this site, it looks like, I'm going to say a serious candidate, but it looks like the site of somebody who's thinking of really being a candidate.
Yeah, that's going to happen. I think she's in it just to promote herself and make more money.
Could be.
I don't think she has any interest in running for president. It's all about filling the coffers, much like our friend Donald.
He seems to be doing quite well.
Quite well for himself. Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. I hope you feel better. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. And now, what's going on in Harrisburg?
Yeah, there's an interesting article, Rick. Governor Corbett has reiterated his position on anti-drilling tax stance to the Marcellus Shale. He told a crowd of local government officials Monday that he would oppose a new state tax on natural gas extraction, even if the industry had not contributed nearly $1 million to his election campaign, and he vowed to protect Pennsylvania's water supplies from drilling-related degradation. I would not let them poison the water, Corbett said, drawing applause from many of the more than 1,500 people who turned out to hear him speak at the annual conference of the Pennsylvania State Association of Township Supervisors.
That's not something you applaud.
They did.
I'm not gonna let them poison the water. Yay! That's not something you applaud. That should be something that goes without saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What a bunch of twisted Nimrods.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. The governor's in control. His party's in control, and these people are pretty much at his mercy.
What a diphthong.
Gas drilling on the Marcellus Shale Formation that stretches beneath much of western and northern Pennsylvania is proliferated rapidly, and the responses to the governor's speech underscores the importance of drilling to the local officials who deal with its benefits and dangers on a daily basis. Quick synopsis of this situation. What he's saying is, and here comes the Republican anti-government sentiment. He said he doesn't want to tax Marcellus Shale extraction because it would go into the general fund. And their idea of the general fund is, well, you're just going to throw it there. It's a big rat hole and it'll never be seen again. And the propensity to spend money will just soak that money up. What he's saying is I would rather allow these local governments to impose their own taxes to take care of the problems of the roads. I think one of the problems in that scenario is, one, you're depriving the taxpayers of Pennsylvania at a time when they need money in their general fund. That's the first point. The second point is this is in our state, and this is our land, so this state of Pennsylvania should benefit. And three, I think some of the problems when you're dealing with Marcellus Shale really are statewide, and you're going to have to deal with it on a statewide basis. So I think some of the presumptions of this administration, I think, don't make a lot of sense, and in the end, he really is catering to people who, let's just say, gave him a good amount of money, and he keeps saying, well, it wouldn't matter. You know, I have doubts about that, Rick. I still think it's about taking care of his big-time donors.
And yes, I did call him a diphthong.
Okay. Another important issue.
And you don't even know what a diphthong is.
Actually, I don't. Do you want to enlighten us?
No, go ahead.
Maybe we can talk about it.
It's a vowel. It's a gliding vowel.
Okay.
It's if I have to give the English lesson. It's like boil, the O-I, the oi sound, boil, and toy, O-Y, oi. It's those letters. It's that whole kind of thing going on there. That's a diphthong. And, yes, I did call it that, which makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, thank you for that information.
Just sharing.
Thank you for sharing.
I need to be...
You are a sharing person.
I need to be fair and balanced.
There you go. Oh, I'm sorry. That's pretty funny. Anyway,
Patriot, one of us that thinks so.
Patriot News had a good, and this is very relevant again, the state liquor stores. According to the Pennsylvania Democrats in the state house, they think that eventually this is going to fail. I hope they're right.
I hope it does fail.
I hope they are right. According to the article, it depends on who you ask. One thing is for sure, the issue of whether the state should sell its 625 liquor stores continues to generate plenty of buzz. How long will the issue be debated is anyone's guess, with House Majority Leader Mike Terzi promising to introduce a bill by early summer. A vote could be inevitable by fall. Proponents argue that the consumers want to buy liquor and wine in supermarkets and convenience stores, and that government should get out of the business of selling alcohol. That could be in for a long fight. When we talk about that, I often hearken back to what you said. You used to be able to, kind of like at McDonald's, just drive up and get yourself a little
give me some liquor.
Liquor. I mean, we make a joke about it, but it really, according to the numbers, and here again, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to kind of
thank you.
A quick synopsis. Your buddy Matt Brulé,
he's
testifying, and what they're doing is kind of backing up. First, Terzi threw those numbers out. He said, you know, we're going to have 650 licenses, and we're going to raise $2 billion or more. Well, then people start doing the numbers. Easy math, and it comes to $2.3 million. And people say, wait a minute. Where do you get these numbers? There's no way you're going to get anything near that. Well, now they're backing up. And they're saying, well, it's really not a core function of government to sell wine and whiskey. So they're going from trying to justify it with the numbers and the money angle. Now they're pushing the, well, it's not a core function. Now here comes Mr. Boulet, and he throws out the figure of in West Virginia, which he claims was the last state to do it. Some of the licenses went for as much as 600, and I believe he's 675,000. Yes.
Yeah, those are in prime areas, though.
Well. But here's the kicker. Right. And as much as. Now, that tells me that some of them went for less, maybe considerably less. And he's saying, according to the numbers he's throwing out, that the average in the country is about 3,000. He's saying that. Is that what we want? 3,000? Do the numbers, Rick? 750? You divide that into 3,000, what do you get? It comes up the crease of 400%. Of state liquor store or stores that sell wine, spirits. Is that what we want in this state? According to Mr. Brulé.
Oh, up to 3,000.
Up to 3,000.
So
that's
not 3,000 for each license, but 3,000 licenses.
No, 3,000 licenses.
Well, yeah. We want
is that what we want in this state? Do we want three or four in a city?
We want liquor on every corner, just like when we were in Washington, D.C.
So I think the more you discuss this, you know, they go from the money angle to the angle of, well, it's not a core function.
It's a failure.
I see more and more opposition. I see at the end of the tunnel. One quick other story, Rick. Tax day. The famous day that the anti-taxers just love to hate. The truth is, taxes are as low as they've been in about 40 years. They go on in this article from Workers Independent News. It goes on to explain a General Electric Corporation paid about zero taxes, which we've noted several times, nothing.
No,
we paid
zero.
Them.
Yes.
We paid them. And it goes on to explain a couple other tax cheats. 2009, ExxonMobil paid no federal taxes. The Republican budget plan gives away even more tax breaks for corporations and the rich. And there's a steady drumbeat from conservatives that taxes are too high.
Let's take a quick break. We're back after this to wrap things up.
Away from the city, the noise and crowds, the freeway rides. But they slashed our funding, they cut all our hours, our Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did the fault become all mine? The president says, tighten the belt, the only one that's tighten is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed her permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember to check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. During the break, William emailed me, and you can email me too, rick@thericksmithshow.com. He said Beck had to get out of town. He heard the white coats were coming. Yeah, because he's freaking nuts. I mean, really, I mean, I feel for the guy. Because I used to listen a little bit every once in a while, a couple 5 minutes, 10 minutes here, you know, just to see what he was saying. And at one point he seemed, you know, kind of, you know, top 40 jockish, you know, the whole shtick, because he was a drunken top 40 jock, you know, did the whole morning zoo thing. So he brought that whole morning zoo shtick to talk radio, which was kind of, you know, different from the, you know, here's the story and this is what I think. So it was kind of interesting. And now he's just gone, A, he's full of himself, and B, way, way off the deep end. Throw him a rope.
When he was at CNN, he was kind of like a moderate conservative. But, boy, he got in Fox, and you're exactly right. He went out the deep end.
Now, this is one of those moments where you go, somebody close to him. I mean, he's going as far. I'd compare him to Michael Jackson without the child thing. Just that far off the mainstream, far off the path.
I would like to know where he gets some of this information. It doesn't even make sense, some of it. It makes very little sense. It's one thing to have a political ideology and try to prove it, but some of the crazy stuff that he comes up with, there's no cohesion.
Well, I'll use a Donald Trump quote when he was talking about Gary Busey. Either Beck is a moron or a genius. I'm leaning towards moron.
Well,
and there I go.
Yeah, I remember
to the Donald.
I remember you saying that he was one of these people that when he was an alcoholic, he did it to excess.
Yep.
Whatever he does to excess, and I believe you're correct.
So maybe we should take him to one of those wet houses and leave him there. Because then he'd probably be a decent human being. You know, I've always found that the folks who've had those problems, and I've known, you know, I used to play in a rock band when I was younger, so I knew a bunch of people who developed those problems early on, and then later in life, you know, they found this grand conversion. Basically, they hit rock bottom. Down at the bottom of the bottle was, you know, somebody holding out a Bible to them, and then they became thumpers. And to be honest, when they were at the bottom of the bottle, they were decent people. They were trustworthy. They were dependable. They were folks you could talk to, have a good time with, and joke around with. They became thumpers. Forget it. Wow. Way out on a curb, preachy, untrustworthy. I got to be honest. You know, along with the guy with the white shirt and the tie and the big smile, hi, how you doing? What can I do for you? The people who've ripped me off, the thumpers. The former drunks, the ones who I have found Jesus, and because I'm born again, I trust me.
Rick, you don't understand. Jesus wants me to be rich.
Yeah, there is that. And Jesus wants a whole bunch of people in prison so he can go visit them. Evidently, that must be it.
Just lack understanding.
And I wish someone would explain it to me. And if you've got some good explanations, rick@thericksmithshow.com would be a good way to do it. Some interesting research has just come out. Might explain why when I drop something on my foot or that time I hit the hammer on my thumb, that I let out a line of very colorful adjectives and
golly gee.
Oh gosh darn.
Oh shucks.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, like you know me around my kids. There have been a couple of times where I've let out
and who was there to admonish you?
Oh, I was there to admonish myself, because I'm much harder on myself than anyone else could possibly be. Evidently, according to researchers at Keele University, they have some, I don't even know where Keele University is, so you figure this out. They say that letting off a string of expletives actually has a dulling effect. So, you know, that sensation of pain, you let out a couple of good, a couple of those words. Helps you feel better. So, you know, I guess, you know, interesting. The Telegraph explained that cursing could trigger a fight or flight response that raises the heart level and the aggression level, which then gets that adrenaline pumping and all of that. And so I guess on one hand, could be possibly, to be honest, it's not going to change how I react to pain because it's almost automatic that the S word comes out immediately or, or a bunch of the other ones, words that...
Or I call myself a
DA. A DA, sure. Well, I do that
anyway. I'm angry at myself.
I do that anyway. You don't need to hurt yourself over that.
You know, like you use a hammer and you hit your nail.
Yeah, well. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for being here. Our guests, State Representative Pam DeLisio, and the Detroit Federation of Teachers President Keith Johnson. Of course, everyone who listened tonight, thank you for being here. And our toad sleazer over there, Brett, man, rough night. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming. Beneath the sway.
Curtain in Pennsylvania. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen every time it does happen, from our chat room moderator Lottie to our news ninjas Gene and Susan to our blogger Texas Betsy, who is off with her bag of curses to scare the daylights out of children during Passover this week, apparently. I don't know. But a happy Passover week to you all who celebrate it. Thanks go out as ever to John Fox and to Ben Birch. Between the two of them, everything technical that has to happen to make this show happen, happens. And again, thanks to Reverbo. And thanks, of course, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.